Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Aurora Grandy, for Tuesday, September 13th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Dickens.
Here.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Here.
Councilmember Arnold.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. The next item is our flag salute, and this evening we have the Aurora Grandy Police Department Explorers, Danny Gregory and Gary Leiter here. Welcome, gentlemen. They're going to lead us in the flag salute. If you would remain standing, our invocation this evening will be given by Pastor George Lepper from Peace Lutheran Church. Gentlemen.
Please stand, face the flag. Salute. Pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please. Dear Father in heaven, we do ask that you be with us this evening and bless this meeting, the council. Give them wisdom as they make their decisions tonight. Bring peace to our world and into our hearts. Comfort those who grieve, and especially be with those this evening, those recuperating and recovering in the aftermath of Katrina. Watch over the police and protect our city workers and our fire department. Be with all those who also serve in our armed forces, especially be with those in harm's way. Lord, be with us tonight. Bless us all. Help us, Lord, to make this a better place to live. And respecting the persons of all faith, we humbly submit this prayer in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. And Danny and Gary, I don't know if you know the routine here or not, but if you show up to do the flag salute, you also get some air time, and you get to tell us about what the explorers have been up to and what you do. So we'd welcome you to share some information with us, if you like.
Good evening. I'm Gary Light. I am a sergeant with the Explorer Program. I'd like to take this time to tell you a little bit about who we are and what we do. Primarily, we are a volunteer group that works in conjunction with the Arroyo Grande Police Department, where we have a huge focus on aiding the city of Arroyo Grande. Some of our events that we've done are things such as the DARE program, which have brought awareness to children to keep them from drug safety, and the Walmart Safety Day, which helps them to view strangers as potential dangerous and things such as that. We've also done things such as security at the Strawberry Festival, where we helped find children who were lost and pretty much bring a safer environment to our festival, as well as parade management at the Harvest Festival. These are all some of the things we do to aid with our city here. Last year alone, our department, Explorers, averaged over 200 hours of community service with the Arroyo Grande City apiece. Now, not only that, one of our other functions is to further the education of these individuals who seek law enforcement. Right now, we do various training every Monday night, including training for a competition we were going to be having next month, as well as a competition arriving in June, a yearly competition in Flagstaff. These are all things that we do to help our own education, as well as help the city of Arroyo Grande. Among these things, we've also aided with the Santa Cop. This is a program that we've done every year where we bring presents and toys to those children who are less fortunate in the community. And this is something that we feel very strongly about and enjoy and do on a very weekly basis and put in a lot of time and effort. And we just wanted to make you all aware that this is a program that we are doing to aid our city, you guys, as well as ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Rachel, why don't you come around here? You can stand right here. That's good. You have to face these folks here. Is that okay? Okay. This is a very special presentation. This evening, Rachel Dewar, is that pronounced right?
Dewar.
Okay. Is being recognized for her recent 4-H award at the Santa Barbara County Fair for her reserve grand champion, white turkey, hen. And Ed is the name. Okay. And for her long-term project, this is special, her long-term project of raising Seeing Eye guide dogs. Every year, 4-H and FFA clubs from South County participate in the Santa Barbara County Fair to show off their animals. This year, there were more than 275 animals entered in the fair by San Luis Obispo County kids and teens. This was the first year that Rachel was old enough to enter an animal at the fair, and she chose turkeys because they are less expensive to take care of and than other animals such as pigs and goats. Is that correct? Good. Okay. Rachel wrote a letter about her experience and then sent it to other 4-H members of her Wasna Valley 4-H Club, friends and family. She also let them know that any money she raised at the sale would go towards training seeing eye dogs. For Rachel, being in 4-H is about giving and donating back to the community. And on behalf of the City Council and the City of Arroyo Grande, we would like to honor and congratulate Rachel for her outstanding accomplishments and for her wonderful contribution towards helping the blind through her efforts with Seeing Eye Dog programs. And Rachel, I have a, get it open here. I have a mayor's commendation. This is presented to Rachel Dewar in recognition of your 4-H award for Reserve Grand Champion at the Santa Barbara County County Fair, dated this 13th day of September 2005. It's my pleasure to present this to you. Good. Thank you. Would you like to say a few words before you walk off and tell us about Ed?
My name is Rachel Dewar, and I took a turkey to the fair, and I had five turkeys at the beginning, and then two of them died, and I had three left, and they were all hens, and I was thinking about taking the turkey that I wanted from the very beginning, but a couple days before the fair, it started limping. So I didn't take that one. I took a different one. And the reason I named it Ed is because someone I know wanted me to name it after him. And so I named it after him. And the other turkey that was limping, I took for a breeding turkey. And then the other turkey I gave to someone else in our 4-H group who didn't have a turkey.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's why this job is so much fun. Okay, on to our second presentation this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce, again, a new organization here in the city of Arroyo Grande. It's our Tree Guild. And there will be a presentation this evening that will kind of give us some background and where we are right now with this organization. And Mr. Scott Dolan?
No, actually, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Scott will speak in a little while. It's hard to follow that last one, though.
That's tough, isn't it?
Mr. Mayor and members of the council, thank you for the opportunity to formally introduce the Tree Guild of Arroyo Grande. I am Gary Sherquist, 228 Short Street. Kristen Barnish and I are co-chairs of the Tree Guild. What is this? The Guild is an environmentally concerned group of citizens, property owners, business owners, and residents. Our members include a landscape architect, an architect, I understand now maybe three botanists, real estate agents, educators, an art historian, engineers, etc. We presently have about 30 members, some who are here tonight. We will work to develop a citywide tree program, and we'll help facilitate the planting of trees throughout the city of Arroyo Grande. We will assist in finding funds for the planting and maintenance of trees. This will involve finding grants, seeking donations, and on occasion asking that the city council appropriate special funds for special projects. To the end of finding funds, the Tree Guild, on a volunteer basis, will be working with the Department of Recreation and Parks to prune side shoots on city-owned trees on a semi-annual basis, thereby freeing up funds for additional and much-needed tree maintenance. The Tree Guild, along with Preserve the Village, will donate 20 to 30 trees to the city for the Nelson Green Renewal Project. We are seeking alternative solutions for repair of root-damaged sidewalks other than removal of the trees. In a moment, Scott will speak to that in a little more detail. We will be working to update and reformat the landmark tree list so that it can better be used as a tool for project review by staff, ARC, and the Planning Commission. I thank the council for this opportunity to introduce the Tree Guild of Arroyo Grande and to present our goals and objectives. We look forward to your support. If I may, I would like to introduce Scott Dowlin, who is a landscape architect, a member of the Tree Guild, works with Caltrans, and works with Caltrans. Scott has practical experience with specifying, maintaining, and preserving trees. Thank you. And Scott?
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Scott Dallin, and I live at 860 Sylvan Ridge in Arroyo Grande. I've been asked by the Tree Guild to speak to you tonight. As a Tree Guild member, I bring to the Guild and to you tonight specific knowledge regarding urban forestry preservation and maintenance and enhancement. I first want to talk to you about preservation. I'm a licensed landscape architect with Caltrans District 5 here in San Luis Obispo. The district stretches from Santa Cruz County in the north to Santa Barbara County in the south. Throughout the district, various communities are struggling with issues of urban forest preservation in conjunction with long-term maintenance and cost. One such example is the city of Salinas in Monterey County. It was there I had the personal experience and opportunity to make a difference. First slide, please. State Route Highway 68 in Salinas runs through the urban core, also known as Main Street. As you can see, the corridor is flanked by 40 to 50-year-old magnolia trees running the length of Main Street. The project was finished August of this year and is considered a pavement rehabilitation, which consists of replacing AC pavement, curb and gutter, damaged drains, and bringing the sidewalk up to ADA compliance. Next slide. Because the sidewalk and curb and gutter had been so badly damaged by the existing tree roots, it was originally suggested that every tree be removed and replaced. This would result in a dramatic change in the appearance of downtown. Through Caltrans efforts and the support of the City Council in Salinas, we were able to save 65 of the 86 trees on Main Street. This was achieved through selective pruning, the use of root barriers, shifting the curb and gutter, and enlarging the tree wells. Next slide. Here's a slide illustrating what we found underneath the sidewalk when it was removed, and it's just a web of tree roots. And the previous slides, you could see the extensive damage that was done to the curb, gutter, and sidewalk, which led us to the initial assessment that all trees had to be removed. And you can go to the next slide, please. When removal was apparent, every effort was made to save the adjacent trees so that we avoid having blocks where we denuded the canopy cover. Caltrans made a commitment to the community to save every tree possible. The city's position was that the aesthetic value of the trees and the commercial benefit to the downtown outweighed the maintenance. The result is a Main Street which has retained the flavor of its past and, in general, a more attractive, and comfortable pedestrian-friendly environment. Next slide, please. I've looked at the condition, and I believe that there are alternatives that would address ADA issues while saving the tree. It is the objective of the Tree Guild to see the city use more creative ways to manage and preserve the urban forest other than removal. Although removal of a tree here and there doesn't seem to be too significant, the cumulative impact could sacrifice the beauty of our city in the long term. And then I'd like to briefly talk about enhancement, our other objective, our other goal as the Tree Guild. As part of the Tree Guild's commitment to participate in the urban forest, or to participate in enhancement of our urban forest, we are going to prepare a street tree master plan for a traffic way extending from Highway 101 northbound off-ramp to Branch Street. Next slide, please. Here's an aerial illustrating, showing traffic way and the area that's in dire need of some trees. We have identified this area as being an important corridor to the community, as it is the southernmost entry and gateway to the village of Arroyo Grande. Next slide. Here's a looking down traffic way towards the north. We see an opportunity to improve its image through the planting of street trees and believe this will make the community more attractive and increase commerce. So I thank you tonight for your time and the opportunity to speak to you this evening. And the Tree Guild looks forward to working with the city in preserving and enhancing our urban forest. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. We're anxious to work with you as well. And there's more. Okay.
I just wanted to let everyone know that I'm, like Gary mentioned, I'm one of the co-chairs of the Tree Guild. And if there are other people in the community who are interested in volunteering and helping us, we would love to have them join our group. They can call me at home. My number is 474-8836. Or they could talk to Gary Sherquist, 474-4200. And I just wanted to say that we really have some really smart people in our group, and we're very excited to help the city do some things that we think we have needed for a long time. Thank you.
And if they called your number, who would they be talking to?
Oh, I didn't say my name.
No.
Kristen Barnich.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else from the Tree Guild before we move on? Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for being here, and those of you who are members of the who have volunteered your time, we really do appreciate it. I think on behalf of the council, we truly do share this common goal with you, and so we're looking forward to working with you in the future, and we appreciate you taking time to be here tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, that takes us to item number 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all other readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to come forward and present any issues, thoughts, suggestions on matters that are not published on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking formal actions on matters that are not published on the agenda. We would ask you to be mindful of the 3-minute rule and also address the council as a whole. Any members of the audience that would like to come forward for community comment?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Bob Lloyd with AGP Video. I just wanted to remind the community that your city-county planning commissions are being aired. They play every other Tuesday that you're not on, and they play for that week period of time. So please tune in for your planning commission meetings. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. I'm being handed a note here, which means that, once again, I forgot to include something, and one of the reasons why we were late convening the meeting this evening is that the council was in closed session, and we discussed real property negotiations. We have no report at this time. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Ed. Did you get it from Tim?
No.
Oh, I thought maybe Tim passed the note over. The will of the council, any items this evening?
None.
Okay. Then I will ask for a motion of approval for consent items 8A through 8J.
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Anything in there this evening, Tim?
No, Mayor Farrar, nothing.
Okay, thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to item 9 this evening, public hearings, and we have several of them. The first one is 9A, consideration of use of State 2005-06 Citizens Option for Public Safety, or COPS funds. Good evening, Chief.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Once again, we bring forward to you is consideration of the expenditure of the fiscal year 05-06 state COPS funds. Quick recap of what it's really all about is this is a grant that we receive each year from the state of California. It's a permanent program in the state budget, but it requires an allocation each year. As part of the use of these funds, it is required that a public hearing be held in September of each year, separate and apart from the regular budget process. These funds cannot be commingled with the city's general fund, in fact, must be kept in a separate account. The law requires that the police chief of jurisdiction develops a spending plan for these funds and brings it to the council for consideration. The last 5 years, we've actually been using the funds to fund a personnel positions within the department. That came to an end this year, and through your budget actions, you integrated those positions into the city's general fund. What I'm proposing this year is really not not spending the funds. I'm proposing to the council that these funds be designated for the upgrade of the police department's base station communication system, which was originally installed in 1987. The system has reached the point where it's requiring a lot of maintenance, and we were just informed by the manufacturer this year that they would no longer be supporting the equipment. What that really means is they're not going to be the supplies or the replacement parts are going to be no longer manufactured, and we'll be able to maintain the system as long as parts can be found somewhere to be plugged into the system. We are currently looking at the possible replacement for the system. However, given the transition that's going to be occurring in the near future as far as the police chief goes, I'm deferring off to whoever the council, city manager, and the city council hires to be the chief to complete that process and come back to you. But in the meantime, I'm recommending that we take these funds and basically hold them for this replacement. It will probably be a 5 or 6 year process, so you'll probably be looking at the chief coming back over the next 4 or 5 years asking for the same thing as far as replacing the communication system. If for some reason that were not to happen, or it would be funded through some other method, or there may be some other actions taken down the line concerning communications, the police chief would then come back to the city council and ask for a redirection of those funds. So, again, tonight it's relatively quick and easy, in that I'm not asking to spend them. I'm asking to hold them. And we can hold them for at least 2 years. So, again, it gives the city plenty of time to work through the development of the new communications base station. Now, there is one part of this, and it's noted in the last paragraph. There is interest from last year that must be spent this year, and I'm asking that the council authorize those funds, $411.87, I believe, to be expended for supplies that we would normally not have budgeted in the general fund budget. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Just one quick question, Rick, and you know, you and I have had a chance, I think, to chat briefly about this, and on the issue of communication, and I, you know, I have no issue, you know, sort of earmarking these funds for that purpose, but the question came up whether or not, in view of the fact that the manufacturer is not going to service this, if we're going to go or the existing equipment, if we're going to go after additional equipment, being mindful of some of the national standards that are coming our way with regard to interoperability. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the new system, again, we already have our communications consultants working on that, and the new system that is being developed is state-of-the-art digital system, complete interoperability regionally and statewide. The state agencies, meaning the CHP, state parks, Fish and Game, Caltrans.
Okay. Okay, good. Any other questions on the staff report? Go ahead.
I have one quick one, Chief. How consistent do we anticipate that the legislature's approval of the COPS funding program to be? Is this something that's likely to go away?
I don't believe so, but understand that answer. I don't believe so.
Sure.
I've been involved in the development of the COPS program in 1987 when it was first developed under Governor Wilson, and I worked under the expansion of the COPS program in 1988 with the new governor, or former governor, I should say, Gray Davis, where it was expanded to a minimum of $100,000. It is a very strong program. It is a permanent program in the state budget process and in the state and as far as state law. It does require an annual appropriation. That's the roll of the dice. However, there has, except for 2 years ago when the budget up in the state was extremely dicey, not that the last couple of years haven't been, but except for 2 years ago, there's never been any hint that the legislature really wants to do away with funding the COPS program. In fact, it was funded up front in the governor's original January budget, and there was never any question about it this year.
Thanks. Just one real just sure. Follow up on the number of years that you can keep using the funds for the same, I'll call it, line item. I know that the other funding had to go away because we couldn't continue to fund it. What is it, 5 years is what I was remembering, and that's why.
Well, actually, in terms of the personnel action, it was actually 4 years, but we were able to ask forgiveness and squeeze out an extra a fifth year. The purpose is that the fund not go towards a permanent program. In other words, not go out forever. What we are proposing in terms of the communication system is a lease purchase program, and as part of the lease purchase, then the funds will be purchasing it off over either a 5 or 6 year period, and yes, that is very permissible.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other comments? Okay, this is a public hearing. If there are members of the audience that would like to come forward on 9A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing portion of 9A and bring this back to the council. Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start us off here?
Yeah, I'm having trouble with this. I mean, obviously, we do need to upgrade the communication system, and if we can essentially, you know, get some state funding to help us get that done, then I'm all in favor of that. I think the lease purchase option is a very good way to go so that we can deal with, if these funds do for some reason become unavailable, we'll be able to handle it within the general plan. So I don't have any trouble with this proposal at all.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I too don't have any issues with this, Rick. I think that this is a prudent plan, and again, it certainly will be reviewed by the individual that we hire in your stead in the future. But I certainly look to you as knowing what the needs are in the department and balancing those things. So I have no problem with this request whatsoever.
Okay, thanks. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I don't have anything else to add either. I think this is a worthwhile program, and I can definitely support it. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I have to echo the same sentiments. I have no problem with this whatsoever.
Matter of fact, I think that even if the legislature fails to appropriate the funds in the future, that it's something that we're going to need to replace this equipment anyway. If we start with this, and then we're going to need to find another source anyway. So I think this is an excellent way to proceed. I can completely support this.
Okay, thanks. All my issues have been addressed, both in side conversations and the discussion this evening. So as much as I wanted to make this difficult for you, Rick, we can't. I mean, it's unanimous. So I too, can support this. Okay, no smart remarks over there. I see what you're doing. Okay, how about a motion? Don't all jump in here at once.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move that we set aside or designate the funds from the Citizens Option for Public Safety Program dollars for the enhancement of the existing communication system.
Second.
And include in that the allocation of the $411.87 as recommended by the chief.
Okay.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to item 9B, consideration of naming a private drive located in track 2310. For members of the audience that would like to come forward on 9B, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Anyone? No one? Close the public hearing portion of 9B. And Councilmember Arnold, why don't we start at your end?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think this is pretty straightforward. The road does need a name, and I have no problem with the name as proposed.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, I too don't have any trouble with the name as proposed.
Okay, thanks. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I too don't have an issue with this. I think this will be fine.
Okay. Boy, this is moving so fast, I'm forgetting names. Mayor Pro Tem?
Well, maybe to slow it down a little bit. I've got no particular problem with the name, but maybe we should name it after Rachel's turkey. Call it Edway. Okay, well, I can go forward with it as is recommended.
I can't follow that one. I don't have an issue with this either. I think the name sounds good, has a nice ring to it, and so I will support it. Don't you wish they were all this easy, Ryan? Yeah. Okay, I will entertain a motion on 9B.
I move a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande named private drive located in track 2310 Parkside, known as Glenbrook Way.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to our third public hearing, 9C, consideration of appeal of Planning Commission's denial of lot line adjustment, case number 05-001.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council.
Hey, Kelly.
Get my PowerPoint up here. The project site is located on Short Street near Arroyo Grande Creek and across from the Nelson Green in the Village Mixed Use District. The site is roughly 8,800 square feet in size and is developed with two small single-family residences and one two-car garage. The property consists of two legally created parcels, Lot 7 and a portion of Lot 8 of the Short, Mason, and Whiteley addition, which was recorded in 1887. The portion of Lot 8 is a narrow strip of land 15 feet wide that was separated by a deed recorded in 1906. Lot 7 is about 6,800 square feet in size, and the portion of Lot 8 is approximately 2,000 square feet. The existing Lot 7 conforms to the 5,000 square foot minimum lot size in the Village Mixed Use District, and Lot 8 does not and is considered unbuildable. The applicant proposes to reconfigure the lot lines to allow for the individual sale of each house. The existing configuration is illustrated by the dashed line on the bottom portion of the map there. The lot line adjustment map shows the property divided more equally, with parcel 1 being 4,292 square feet in size, and then parcel 2 being 4,521 square feet. This is a flag lot configuration. As the map shows, the stem width is only 12 feet, and the development code requires 18 feet. It should be pointed out that this is the net size of the parcels and not the gross size. The difference is that the gross area includes the public right-of-way to the middle of the adjoining street, as well as any other public easements, and the net area just simply does not. Unlike other mixed-use districts within the city, but they specifically go by the gross area. However, the village mixed-use district measures minimum lot size on the net site area. The Planning Commission considered this project on July 19th and denied the project based on the inability to make two of the required findings for approving lot line adjustments. The first finding for denial states that the lot line adjustment constitutes poor land use planning and an undesirable lot configuration. The original Short, Mason, and Whiteley subdivision, as shown on the overhead there, did not include any flag lot configurations, and only a couple of flag lots were created within the vicinity, which assessor record one non-conforming lot. As previously stated, one of the lots is greater than 5,000 square feet, and the other one is significantly less than that. Although the proposed adjustment would make the smaller lot more conforming, the result is that both lots are less than 5,000 square feet. This clearly does not better the situation, which is the whole intent of lot line adjustments. This slide is something that the applicant submitted in response to Planning Commission concerns. This revised plan allows for a flag lot with a stem width of 15 feet and maintains only one non-conforming lot. However, if even the stem is increased to 18 feet, the development code states that flag lots shall be approved only when they conform with the existing character of the neighborhood in which they were proposed to be located. So this then becomes the most important aspect of consideration and goes back to the first finding with regards to character of the neighborhood. So, in conclusion, it is recommended that the City Council adopt a resolution denying Appeal 05-004 and uphold the Planning Commission's denial of Lot Line Adjustment 05-001. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly. Any questions? Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Kelly, on Attachment 3, it's an aerial photo. There was a little flag piece. I think the line was inadvertently drawn there, and I just want to make sure that that is not part of it would, in essence, have run behind. Let me see here if I can. It would have probably run behind lots like 8, 9, and 10. Yeah, it's this aerial photo right here.
Yours is in much better condition than the one that I have in the reproduced copy. Can you describe or point to me?
You want to borrow this one,
yeah,
Kelly? Yeah. Why don't you come get this one?
We've got five of those, so.
Joe and I will share.
The record that this is a both Rob Strong and Jim Bergman have are missing in action and vacation, and so I'm not real familiar with this project.
If you look at the subject property, there's what looks like already a flag stem with a car actually parked in it. but every other map does not show that. And so I'm assuming this flag piece was actually inadvertently shown. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. I see what you're talking about. Yeah, that's right.
That is not actually part of this property.
Right.
Okay. That's the only question
I see what you're saying.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions on the staff report? This is a public hearing, and we typically allow the applicant to go first. So if there's anyone here, Mr. Sturgis or a representative?
Mayor Pro Tem, council members. My name is Dave Sturgis, and I reside at 325 Short Street in the Village. The appeal now before you is regarding a proposed lot line adjustment at 130 Short Street. In your packet from staff, you have a letter to the Planning Commission from Mr. Belcher. In that letter, John makes a compelling argument for granting this lot line adjustment. He clearly outlines the legal issues, and your own counsel, Mr. Carmel, has agreed that the legality of the parcels is not in question. So there is no question that, in the eyes of the law, this proposed lot line adjustment could be done with the stroke of a pen. Therefore, the only issue to debate is whether allowing this is in the best interest of the community, my neighbors in the village. You may have noticed that Mr. Belcher is not with me tonight. At your last meeting, he was 0-2. Which led me to believe that this body is lawyer-averse. I, too, tend to believe that if it wasn't for attorneys, we wouldn't need attorneys. So here I stand representing myself and, as fate would have it, have a fool for a client. The property in question, for those of you that haven't seen it, consists of two old houses in a sorry state of... This plot plan illustrates what exists.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Need a pointer?
How's that gizzy work?
Just a button there. We'll give you a red dot.
Ooh. Neato. Wrong one, Kelly. Yeah. Thank you, there. This plot plan illustrates what exists. The original Lot 7 is Parcel 1, and the narrow strip next to it, Parcel 2, is 15 feet of Lot 8. My original idea was to keep the lots approximately the same size by separating them at the existing fence. I would then grant an easement access to the back house, delineating the existing driveway as the easement. Let's go to the next one, Kelly. This shows that adjustment. This shows a lot line now bisecting the property, and there's the access easement on the right side of Parcel 2. The planning department, who wanted a PUD right from the start and for reasons I'll never understand, said, oh, we've decided you can't use gross square footage and therefore this configuration is illegal because you now have two non-conforming lots. Okay, fine. Let's go to the next one, Kelly. Thank you. So to remedy the situation, I included the existing drive, which was an easement, in the legal description of the rear lot. The rear lot became 5,127 square feet and the front lot 3,685 square feet net. So that left the conforming lot conforming and improved the size of the non-conforming one improving the situation is one of the criteria for granting or allowing a lot line adjustment. But then, just prior to the Planning Commission meeting, the Planning Department decided that a flag lot with a 12-foot access, even though that's what exists now, was too narrow. They searched the development code and found criteria for an 18-foot width restriction, allowing that a 15-foot access was probably okay, since they had recently approved one at that dimension. I argued to no avail that that code citation was for new lot creations and not lot line adjustments to improve an existing situation. So back to the drawing board. I came up with this last configuration. Thank you, Kelly. This time, as you can see, I used the front half of the existing 15-foot lot, this at the suggestion of the planning department, incidentally, on the opposite side of the property as access to the rear lot. This configuration supposedly met all of their criteria. No such luck. Now, to the staff report that you have in front of you, I'm going to skip over most of it because it really isn't clear which plan they're referring to most of the time. On page 2 of that staff report, just above the chart, staff states, quote, "In essence, the applicant is making a discretionary request to enable the creation of two buildable lots. I am not requesting to create anything, merely for permission to change the legal descriptions of two existing lots." Under item number 5, just below the chart, staff states, referring to alternative 1, that, quote, "Granting the lot line adjustment would produce a need for an access easement and would create a de facto flag lot with a stem width of 12 feet. Staff has a penchant for stating the obvious. An access easement is required and appears on the drawing. It'd be alternative 1 on that. The definition of the word de facto is that which exists or is such in fact. So what they're telling you is that I would create that which already exists. My point exactly. They cite Municipal Code 16-20-050-C-6, stating a minimum stem width of 18 feet is required. The title of Municipal Code 16-da-da-da-da is, quote, "Standards of Land Divisions." Nothing to do with lot line adjustments. It doesn't even apply to lot line adjustments. They ignore the fact that this code restriction is for new land divisions that create new flag lots. The last sentence in this paragraph says, if this lot line adjustment application is approved, it will set a precedent for many more flag lots to be created in the heart of the village. Please, if that were true, the creation of the flag lot at 222 Short Street a few years ago with a 12-foot access would have made this application a slam dunk. Skip to page 4 in that same staff report, please. At the bottom of changing anything physically. Why on earth would you not do that? Under the heading alternative review process, staff suggests that their emphasis of the PUD was so they could, quote, address currently insufficient amenities such as covered parking. Well, according to your design guidelines, the current amenities are just fine. Covered parking is not required in this district. And they would give me a density bonus to get it. This is truly a historic site. And I don't think anyone, save the planning department evidently, wants to see it crammed full of modern units. Even though it's not required in the guidelines, I'd consider doing anything to improve the property if they'd just ask. They go on to additionally justify the PUD by saying that it would afford the protection of, quote, architectural review committee review to ensure compliance with the design guidelines and standards for historic districts. Well, I've been in front of the ARC twice already on this project, and they are indeed very much a factor in the design and review process, so I don't know how a PUD would give them any more input. In closing, I've discussed 3 different lot line adjustment alternatives. The first splits the parcels horizontally rather than vertically and provides access to the rear parcel via an easement over an existing driveway. This alternative is probably the best since it preserves more of the lot's usable space. The second alternative, including the driveway as part of the rear lot, is functionally the same. The third alternative, giving the rear lot its own access via a 15-foot strip on the opposite side of the lot from the existing drive, is probably the least attractive of all because it seals the fate of the rear house as a teardown. This is because the access would be on the opposite side of the lot from the existing garage. I've tried repeatedly over the past months to work with your planning staff to find a way to make this dog hunt. They, Mr. Strong, of course, are adamant about doing a PUD. It just seems silly to me to choose a long, protracted, and expensive process to accomplish the same thing as a simple lot line adjustment. If their unspoken motive is to be able to add conditions to the approval, which are not allowed in a lot line adjustment, all they had to do was tell me what they wanted, and I'd probably agreed to do it. But they didn't. So I leave it to you. And according to staff on page 4, you have several alternatives other than direct denial. I'm open to any of them. If I may, I would reserve the right to speak again and respond to council members' comments. I do have a technical representative, Mike Stanton. He did the work on these maps for the project, and he would like to say a few words regarding the legal procedures involved here. Mike? Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor and council members. My name is Michael Stanton. I live at 775 Los Ciervos in Rio Grande. I'm also the land surveyor representing David Sturgis on this project. I reviewed the title history to the parcels in question and have determined that there are, in fact, two existing legal parcels. As I'm sure the city is aware, the lot line adjustments are specifically exempt from the State Subdivision Map Act. The exemption reads as follows. A local agency or advisory agency shall limit its review and approval to a determination of whether or not the parcels resulting from the lot line adjustment will conform to the local general plan, any applicable coastal plan, and zoning and building ordinances. So it is clear that the legislature's intent was to exempt the lot line adjustment from the normal discretionary review that is typical of subdivisions. This would include either parcel maps or tract maps. Both alternative number 2 and 3 that David has presented meet the minimum parcel size requirement of 5,000 square feet gross. The two existing residents meet the setback requirements of 5 feet under the city's zoning ordinances. However, the garage was constructed over 60 years ago where there were no zoning standards, and this structure does not meet current setback requirements. Chapter 16.20, also known as the Standards of Land Divisions, was used in the staff report as a basis for denial. Under state law, this part of the local ordinance is not applicable to lot line adjustments. Specifically, they are exempt. After a review of the city's goals under the general plan for the downtown village core, the primary purpose of the area designated as village core is to provide for the continuation and development of commercial, office, residential, recreational, and community land use types that reflect and are compatible with the historic small-town nature of the original Arroyo Grande Village area. Since this project includes two existing structures, no new development is proposed. It is easier to conclude that we are continuing the existing residential land use type that reflect the small-town atmosphere of the village. This project is consistent with the goals outlined in the general plan. I have been involved with many lot line adjustments under the county's jurisdiction. The county's policy in working with county council is that the lot line adjustment should create a situation which is equal to or better than that which existed prior to the lot line adjustment. The lot line adjustment does not have to meet current standards for land divisions. They have found this policy to be legally defensible over the years. From a purely legal standpoint, the city cannot deny the lot line adjustment simply because they don't like it or because it is, quote, poor land planning. The findings for denial must be based on nonconformance with either the general plan or building and zoning ordinances. Rob Strong has mentioned that he didn't want to establish a precedent for flag lots in the city. However, in reviewing the assessor's maps, it is clear there are many similar lot configurations with flag lots around the city which have been approved in recent years. It is important to note that any precedent that may be established with this project will not be based on the development because there is no development being proposed with this application. The structures will remain the same. The density remains the same. The traffic remains the same. City services to these parcels will remain the same. Emergency access will remain the same. And the character of the neighborhood will also remain the same. The only change is on paper. The applicant is only applying to move an existing lot line between two legal lots by a 90-degree angle. This is not a subdivision. In my opinion, the only legally defensible action the city can make is to improve one of the three alternatives for the lot line adjustment with a condition that the existing garage on the rear parcel be demolished since it does not meet the setback requirements. I'm available for questions if you have any other questions. Thank you.
Was there anyone else, Mr. Sturgis, that you wanted to have speak?
I would like to speak.
Okay. Please come forward to the podium and state your name.
My name is Mary Margaret.
Could you come to the podium?
My name is Mary Margaret Curzon, and I've lived in the village since 1961. And presently I live right next door to the lot we're speaking about. And it's been an eyesore ever since I've been there, and I think it's wonderful that Mr. Sturgis has seen fit to come in and conform to the style of the village. And like he said, the only thing that's different is a line. Everything else will stay the same. And I think it's terrible that people like him are going to be discouraged from coming in and developing and doing good things. And I'm very much against him not being able to do that. And it just doesn't make sense to me. They pointed out all the other reasons that it should go through, and they make sense to me. And I'm very disappointed that he's come up against the Planning Commission this way. And I would like to see him go ahead with his plan, because I think it's really good. I intend to live there another 25 years, and I like what he's doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else representing the applicant? Okay. This continues to be a public hearing, so if there's anyone else who would like to come forward and comment on this item, this would be an opportunity. Okay. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing portion of this. And Mr. Sturgis, if we do have questions and staff directs them to you, we may ask you to come forward. Okay. Councilmember Dickens, why don't you begin here?
Mr. Mayor, I have a couple questions to staff before I make my comments. Tim, there was some comments made from a representative that did the land use and talked about the fact that we're not able, from a legal standpoint, to look at the fact that whether this is poor land use planning or not when we're dealing with a lot line adjustment. Can you clarify some of the issues in regards to whether or not we're proceeding in a legal manner and the things that we are dealing with are pertinent to tonight's hearing?
Councilmember Dickens, I'd be glad to. The provision that was recited out of the Subdivision Map Act is accurate. It's excluded from the provisions of the Subdivision Map Act. And the limitation is, as was stated, that the lot line adjustment will conform with local general plan, applicable coastal plan, and zoning and building ordinances. And you'll find in your zoning code the section dealing with lot line adjustments, which requires certain findings to be made. And those findings are perfectly appropriate, legal, and the proceedings that are before you are entirely legal. In other words, yes, you need to actually now look at the findings and see if they can be made in an affirmative manner. One thing that's getting a little bit confusing for me, and I don't mean to digress, it seems as though we're here talking about alternatives, and that gets very confusing, and we need to kind of stop that now. The Planning Commission considered an application submitted by Mr. Sturgis, the applicant. It wasn't a range. It wasn't A, B, C, D, or E. In this case, I think we're just dealing with A, B, or C. It was A. It was whatever was on his application. That's what the Planning Commission dealt with. That's they addressed findings only with regard to that particular submission, that application. What you're seeing today are sort of ad hoc planning at the podium, and that happens all the time. But I want you to focus on what's before you. That was the application that was submitted by Mr. Sturgis, not a variation of that. I don't know exactly what he was speaking of with regard to B and C. I know A was what was submitted. The resolution in your packet deals with that configuration, the application that was submitted. So I think it's important that you excise those other alternatives, if you will, from your discussion, because here you're dealing with an appeal of a Planning Commission decision. The Planning Commission wasn't afforded the opportunity to address A, B, C, D, and E. It was requested to look at an application, and that's what you're dealing with. So if we can bring it back to the application, which I believe was the configuration that was shown as item A, the 12-foot wide stem, that's what we're dealing with. And with regard to the findings and the appropriateness of delving into these proceedings, yes, they're legal. It's been done before. I don't think Mr. Stanton was indicating that you could not address those findings, and for some reason the MAP Act was preempted all aspects of lot line adjustments. Our code deals with lot line adjustments, and I know I'm going on and on, but yes, it's perfectly legal to continue in the process.
Thank you, Tim. That's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you for the clarification. Kelly, if I may, what is the zoning designation on this particular property?
Village mixed use.
Okay. Mixed use meaning commercial and residential?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we talk about this legal lot or a portion of a legal lot 8. There must be the other portion of legal lot 8 is someplace else. Has that been developed?
I believe there's a residence on the adjacent lot, Lot 8, the remainder of it.
Do you know the history on that and why did the legal Lot 8, was that split at one point and for what purpose?
All I know is that there was a separate deed recorded in 1906 that created that 15-foot strip. And for whatever the circumstance was at that time, the subject property, the owner at that time, wanted that property, that additional property, for some reason. I don't know why.
Okay. Okay. That answers. Thank you. Appreciate that. Well, actually, I have one other question. In regards to the appeal, Kelly, in the past, you know, and certainly the presentations that were made here in the past, what we've seen is there needs to be evidence brought forth, in my opinion, as to why the Planning Commission, you know, is making a mistake in this particular judgment, in a sense. And the only thing I can see in the packet that we received was really the letter over and above that was done afterwards by the applicant's attorney. Which I find certainly a lot of opinion, but not a lot of fact. And is so, am I correct in saying via that the appeal of the Planning Commission's decision, the information that I have is really this letter by Mr. Belcher, and then of course then the information that's being presented tonight in the hearing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. With that clarification in my mind, what I see here is a couple of issues. One is that I have to look at my job tonight is to look at whether the Planning Commission acted appropriately and made a decision that is, at least in my opinion, correct and concise. I don't see any evidence necessarily brought forth this evening that would tell me that their decision should be reversed. I certainly see certain opinions about this particular piece of property, its functionality and its purpose, but I guess I would ask, you know, the applicant, if you buy a piece of property and it's serving a particular function, you bought it in that particular function, and now we want to change it by basically being able to sell it in two different pieces. Yes, that may seem appropriate, and because that's the use. My concern is that what happens to that property in the future, and how does that then allow? It opens up, in my opinion, the ability for there to be a lot more development. The statement was made that that there will be no new development is proposed, and that's correct. The lot line adjustment is not proposing any new development on that property, but what it does do is it provides the potential for, in my opinion, some entitlements that would actually, if push came to shove, would actually change the character. So bottom line is, for me, I'm looking at what the Planning Commission decided to do, and I, too, concur that there are these two findings that I would have a difficult time in making as well, and I see no reason why we would appeal or approve an appeal of their decision, and I would uphold their decision at this particular time. So that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Well, I think I share many of Councilman Dickens' observations here. I think specifically on what's before us, I don't have any trouble with upholding the Planning Commission's findings here either. I don't think that these do meet our minimum requirements. So I guess, again, on specifically what's in front of it, looking forward at some other potential involving flaglots, I will say that we have had trouble with flaglots in the past, specifically related to a fire you might remember 3 or 4 years ago, where the fire department could not fight the fire in the back house because there wasn't room to get the fire truck in. And it created a specific health and safety issue for the city. And I think going forward that we're looking at certainly at a minimum of 18 feet. But we're also looking at other requirements that were required at that time that we're unable to do here. So I guess where I'd say going forward is I'm kind of mixed about this, whether we would use some sort of path where we would deny it without prejudice, as we've done with some other projects. I don't know if you can do that in an appeal process. You can uphold, deny the appeal without prejudice. I don't know if that's doable, but
I believe you could.
Okay. And then reserve judgment on whether a flag lot is appropriate in the village. I think the fact that there's one other flag lot a couple of blocks down does not necessarily establish that is the appropriate use. In fact, in general, I would say we'd want to discourage flag lots. I guess where I look at going forward is I have to say I'm not quite sure that I see what's gained by a PUD. Except that maybe there is some limit to the size of the back house, because it is, in fact, the development potential here is for how much larger the house that could be built on the back lot could be through some other process. So I certainly don't have any trouble with upholding the Planning Commission's denial of this project and denying the appeal, but would be inclined to do it without prejudice, looking forward to considering an 18-foot flag lot if in fact there's no other way to accomplish this. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have one question for you, Kelly. Are the homes, the two different homes, are they on separate services right now?
Yes.
They are. Okay. I'm going to kind of follow Councilmember Guthrie's remarks and Councilmember Dickens in that I don't think we've seen anything tonight that would warrant overturning the Planning Commission, specifically since what we've been told that we are really only looking at the option A as it was proposed. And with that option, we would be creating two non-conforming lots. With that said, I also am a little troubled with the thought of not being willing to look at something else only because, in essence, especially since they are on separate meters, that they are being used as two different homes and they have that ability. I understand the risk with if we were to move the line just as it is and the fact that no conditions, I understand you as the applicant are willing to actually have conditions placed on you. Unfortunately, we are not able to place conditions on you with a lot line. So I think that's why staff was actually looking for maybe the PUD process to allow, because I would be very concerned with doing a simple lot line adjustment today and then see that back lot sold off and tore down and a large two-story home or something else come on there. I think we're seeing that as a risk in the village right now where older homes are being torn down, and when there are no conditions really being placed on the lots, homes that are inappropriate are being built on them. So I would be very hesitant to do anything, especially at such a very visible location in the city, in the village, do anything that could encourage the character in that area being changed dramatically. I personally am not a fan of flag lots, but when you do have an existing condition where, in essence, we do have a de facto flag, I'm not inclined to say absolutely no way would I consider it. I think one of the differences with these two properties versus some of the other parcels is for someone else to create a flag, I think they would have to actually do a lot split to create a flag. They don't have a little sliver lot laying around that they can actually do a lot line adjustment. So that I'm not sure that we'd be looking at a real severe precedent being set here, but I do believe that this is probably the inappropriate way to go about accomplishing what you'd like to accomplish. So I would recommend that you probably bring it back to the planning with some of your alternatives and let them consider them fully. But as far as the actual appeal goes, I will be denying the appeal. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. I've got a quick question for staff. Is the process of using the net area and not the gross area consistently applied in this district?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Sturgis, I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying tonight, and I'd like to see us find a way to make it work. That said, let me go back and come back to the essence of what we're doing. It's already been set up here. We have to look at the original denial that was put forward by the Planning Commission, and there are reasons for it, and the reasons for it are sound. I can't see any reason to overturn them. However, we're talking about an existing property with two houses on it, the one in the back. If it's going to be a problem with a flag lot with a 12-foot access in the future, it's still a problem today with a 12-foot access. And I think that's something we have to try to address and see what we can do about rectifying. I'd very much like to see you come back before the city, whether it's at the Planning Commission or whatever the appropriate body is, and come forward with a proposal that we can all agree on that will preserve the houses. At this point, if we make the split today, someone could come in tomorrow, whether it was, and you may have no intention of doing this, they could come in, tear down the building and back, and do something else with it. And we could end up with something that doesn't fit in the village. You're saying your intent is to preserve that structure and to renovate it and leave it there. And I think that would be great, but I'd like to see it happen if we can find a way to make it safely accessible, too. So I'm going to have to uphold the Planning Commission's actions and turn down your appeal, but again, without prejudice or however else we can state it, but hope that you can come back and we can see this work somehow. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Kelly, I have a question on page 4. As the applicant pointed out, there was a discussion, page 4 of the staff report, there was a discussion of the alternative review process, and there's a description here of a PUD or similar process, as it states, to allow improvements to the property that could, through density bonuses, result in an additional unit and also address currently insufficient amenities such as covered parking, et cetera, et cetera. And I can appreciate the additional economic aspects of a PUD. But if we were to look at the application of the concept of a PUD to this particular property, can you just give us a rough idea of what some of the potential here might be?
Well, as you know, the PUD process allows for deviation from some of the typical development standards, such as lot size, which is the 5,000 square feet that we're dealing with, trying to aim at with just a lot line adjustment, setbacks, those kinds of things. The density within the village mixed use is 15 dwelling units per acre, so through the PUD process, he could actually get more units. If, I don't know if that's the desire of the city to actually do that or not. The PUD process also allows for very specific review, very detailed review of all aspects, including the architecture, the colors, the materials, those kinds of things. And because the PUD also requires a tentative map to go with it, then you get all the typical conditions for improvements along with it.
Okay, given the village mixed-use designation and focusing on the term density bonuses, would there be an opportunity on this particular lot to put some of the the concepts that we currently use in some of the other areas of town, such as what I've discussed with Steve many times, the concept of using micro lots with a common space, common open space, dealing creatively with access and parking and that sort of thing. Does that potential exist here?
Certainly. The only thing I would mention is you would need to also take into consideration character of the neighborhood, if it would fit. But certainly that's what the district is for.
Certainly the design guidelines would remain intact. Essentially what we would be doing is making one big lot out of this and then looking at a mixed use, or not a mixed use, but perhaps a more denser project that conformed to the character of the village, but introduced new concepts, which of course would mean the existing homes there might have to be, we might be looking at new development. There's two things that concern me about this, and these are kind of broad considerations. The first is the location of it, and as was mentioned, I'm concerned for a couple of reasons. Number one, the proximity to the swinging bridge, the proximity to Nelson Green, the proximity to Heritage Square. This is becoming a tourist attraction. Every time we have events in the village, this becomes kind of a center of activity more and more these days. In addition to that, people who just visit the village and walk across the swinging bridge, it would be nice if they could look to their right and see something perhaps a little more attractive in its presentation than what we have existing there currently. Which leads me to the whole issue of perhaps considering the benefits. And I believe that even though there might well be some economic impact on the front end, on the back end of a potential application of a PUD concept to that lot, might prove to be very profitable in the long run. And we have a lot of examples of that, I think, in the city. The other aspect that I need to be mindful of, and I've mentioned this the last meeting, and I'm going to mention it now, particularly as this continues forward, the discussion on this continues forward, and that is the proximity to the creek. And the admonishment right now that anything that happens on that lot that in any way, shape, or form has a negative impact on the Arroyo Grande Creek in terms of siltation, any of that stuff, is something we're going to hold it pretty much in high priority right now. I think there's some potential here, and the fact that that the city attorney indicated that we pretty much have a narrow scope today. You put forth one alternative to the Planning Commission. They rendered a position on that, which you appealed, and it came to us. And then during the meeting, we were presented with some other alternatives here, which obviously have not been vetted by the Planning Commission. So therefore, our reaction tonight is somewhat limited. So, I'm going to join my colleagues in denying the appeal, again, without prejudice, hoping that perhaps with some additional follow-up and I'm not saying that none of these alternatives would not work, but they certainly have to go through the process. As time-consuming and as arduous as it appears from time to time, that is the system that we have in the city. It's got to go back through the Planning Commission. They have to look at this. They've got to, again, vet it, and then it may come to us again. So that's pretty much where we're at this evening. But I seriously would encourage perhaps some additional communication and dialogue on the potential for applying the concept of a PUD here. I think there's some potential here. Anyway, that's my thought on this issue. And again, I'm going to join my colleagues in denying the appeal. Okay, with that, I will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion for a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande denying appeal case 05-004 and upholding the Planning Commission's denial of lot line adjustment 05-001 applied for by Dave Sturgis, located at 130 and 132 Short Street.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
If I can just interject, Mr. Mayor, in looking at the resolution itself, the wording in the substantive provision is with prejudice, so we're going to change that based on the direction of the council to without prejudice.
Appreciate that amendment. Thank you.
Okay. And we had a second with that amendment?
Correct.
Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to continued business, 10A, consideration to approve a water wheeling agreement with the Oceano Community Services District for the Christie Family Subdivision. Good evening.
Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is continued from the August 9th meeting. At the meeting on August 9th, the council considered a request from Robert and Cindy Christie regarding a possible water wheeling arrangement to provide water to their property on Stagecoach Road. At that time, council requested that there be an investigation of the potential for using a private water system or using an existing collapsed well in the Stagecoach area. The Circle 2 Water Company was identified as having 10 connections with the ability to go to 16 under state law, which provides a potential of up to 6 additional shares. The system consists of 2 wells and a 44,000-gallon storage tank. Increasing the connections to 16 would require an additional 50,000 gallons of storage capacity. Circle 2 was contacted, but it is already in negotiations to provide additional water on behalf of the Bott family. Therefore, the Bott family will require 4 shares, leaving only 2 shares remaining, which is not enough to supply the Christie family with the 4 shares that they need. The council requested that the possibility of a collapsed well in the area might be of some benefit. The Christies prepared a flyer, canvassed the 20 homes in the area, and at this time there is no information available regarding the location or existence of a collapsed well. Therefore, the Christies have renewed the request to the city to provide the water wheeling agreement with Oceano Community Services District to supply water through the city's system to their property. Also, as part of the action this evening, we are again recommending changes to the city's policy regarding water wheeling, as was presented at the previous council meeting. This concludes my report. I would be happy to answer any questions that the council may have. We also have Terry Orton, the engineer for the project, as well as the Christie family.
Okay. Any questions on the staff report? Councilmember Arnold.
Right now, the property is serviced by a community water system. Is that correct?
Actually, at the moment, there is nobody providing water to the service. I believe that it could be addressed better by Terry Orton, their engineer.
No, it's done by a shared well system.
Okay, shared well.
Why don't you stay close there?
Okay. I guess my question is, there are two shares right now that are going to be possibly left over from the Circle Water Company. Is there, so those could provide partial water for this. Is there, I guess my question is, is it not economical to do a partial from one and partial from the Oceano? Is that the reason why those are no good?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Terry Orton, Westland Engineering. I'll identify myself on this. We need to have community water for all four of the Christies. And so we can't use a shared well system for two and a community for two. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I knew someone was going to ask that question because I'm looking at there are two shares hanging out there. And so why not use those two and then maybe use the shared water for the other two? So that answers the question. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any other questions on the staff report?
Just one. The problem with the 16 shares, is that because there's not enough capacity or is there just a limit on that kind of small water company, I believe they call it?
There's a lot of questions there. You may not realize it. The requirement the county has that they're working under is that they need to use a community system. And the maximum the state small system can go is 16.
Okay.
So that,
that's actually the question I was asking.
Okay. Any other questions on the staff report?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, if I may, just to clarify
sure.
that point. And I'm going to preface this a little bit prior to my question, is that part of the problem that I'm having is that we're saying that there's certain things that cannot be done, and there were certain conditions placed on the Christies by the county. Why are the Christies required to have a community service as opposed to shared well? Why is the county requiring that?
It's set up as a condition of approval by their planning commission is how it was done. And it was one of the things that was listed that they had it set up. Normally, that is done, not in this particular case, but normally it's done to get smaller lot sizes. If you're going to go for, you know, 1 acre sizes or something like that, then you have to go with a community system. But for whatever reason it was that the county set it up, that is the condition.
Just like conditions that we place on things, those conditions can be amended at the county?
It's been through the hearing process. You'd have to go back and reconsider it, and
right.
Yeah.
My point was that it's not that it can't be done; it just needs to be appealed to the county.
Yeah, I just don't know if it can or can't. Is the thing. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? All right. This is not a public hearing. However. Obviously, the concerned parties are here this evening. If you would like to come forward and make any comment, feel free.
Terry Orton with Westland Engineering. The Christies have put together a little slide presentation up here, and I'll try to go through it fairly quickly. I don't have the clicker down, so I've got my trusty.
There you go. There's a pointer right there.
There you go. Oh, pointer. Okay. Probably wouldn't need this too much. Basically, what we've tried to do is very quickly go over what we think are pertinent things. They're actually covered mostly within the staff report and that sort of thing, but I just want to just quickly go over it. And what we've been doing with the coming up with this is we've tried to come up with a procedure and worked with the different staffs that are involved. We've worked with your fire chief. We've worked with OCSD, and now we're asking to work with you also on this. And we feel that based on what we're doing, we're not going to be making anything precedent-setting for the future, and that was brought up at the last meeting as to why we feel that that's not the case. So if you go on to the next. Here is a slide that quickly goes over to, because one of the questions at one point that was asked is where is the water coming from and whether or not that the water is able to be used. And this indicates to you that the water that is being proposed to be used here is state water and therefore doesn't run into any of the problems that you have if you're using water from another source that might be in conflict with other problems that the agreements take place. Next, please. I mentioned earlier that we've been working with staff of all the different agencies on this. One of them is in coming up with whether or not that there was capacity to wheel the water. We've talked, of course, with your own staff, with your city engineer and your engineering department regarding this, and it comes out that it's their opinion that they have adequate capacity in the lines to be able to use it. And we've also gone through again through the OCSD to ensure that this water is available and can be used for both fire and for the domestic purposes. Go ahead, please. The agencies, as you probably know, we've gone through just about everywhere. We went through the county, we went through LAFCO, OCSD, and this is actually the last place is to make the determination of whether there is adequate capacity in the lines to take this water to the particular project or not. And we have asked all the people who are processing at the county whether or not there's any problems with anything that's going on. And everything has been approved to be able to allow this to take place. And so, again, this is our last step on it. And I thank you very much. And if there's any technical questions, I know that Christie's would like to say a couple items, too, but I'd be able to try to answer those.
One quick
question. Sure.
You put up a deal on the unused allocation from OCSD and their projected demand. Mm-hmm. What happens if their projected demand, which ultimately will happen, reaches the 1728? What happens to your 5-acre fee?
Well, at this point, we are contracted. If we actually are able to sign based upon what happens here, that water is contracted to us
In perpetuity. So even though the water that they purchase for their community, they're selling to you permanently.
Yes, but do keep in mind they're also, it's the same concept as the way I understand they're working with you also to get water as a backup for your system here. When they went out and looked for this water, they looked for more water than they needed for their build out that they were looking for. And their concept was they were trying to plan with an idea towards how much they would need in the future. And at this particular point, what they're at this point saying is that they're going to use a certain amount for us out of that planned amount. Now, they may at some particular time, you know, enlarge their sphere of influence if that's an appropriate term.
Or increase their density, or, I mean,
in whatever way. But this will be contractually obligated to this particular property.
And what I'm saying, if they did expand their sphere of influence and needed
they'd have to go find more water.
So you're now essentially part of their water system.
That would
because
be
the arguing with them is actually quite a bit different than that.
I know.
Okay.
But yes.
We never fully trust technology.
Good idea. Especially PowerPoint.
That's right. I wanted to, Bob Christie, 624 Stagecoach Road, Arroyo Grande Fringe. I wanted to add one comment regarding the shared well that Councilman Dickens asked about. We are currently one partner in a four-partner well-sharing agreement that cannot be changed, so that we cannot go to the county and say we want to do a well-sharing agreement for our four parcels because we don't have four shares in a well-sharing agreement. It's not only the process, it's you have to have the water or you have to have the shares to do that. Well sharing agreement with just four shares, you cannot expand beyond that without converting it to a state small water system, and that's where we got hung up originally, and so that's why we're here, of course. I want to cover the points that I felt were brought up, and perhaps actually looking at what Terry said, we may have a little bit of overlap, but I'll try to avoid that. One of the questions that came up was the conflict in land use policy of Arroyo Grande, and we don't find any conflict. The city plan states that the city must not encourage development that border outside its borders that requires rezoning, but our project does not require any or encourage any rezoning. It simply works within the existing zoning requirements. Another point that I think is important in terms of just general planning and development is that our project is consistent with the gradual transition in land use from the city of Arroyo Grande out into the through the residential suburban into the rural, from city lots to the 1.3 acres across the street from Canyon Crest to ultimately the 2.5 acre minimums the county imposes on the area that begins with our property outside the city. Can we? Okay. Now I'm going to use my little pointer here. This little X is our parcel right there, and this is the fringe area. That's the transition I'm talking about here. The next one, please. And this is another, I borrowed this from LAFCO, a larger picture. The yellow is Canyon Crest, and we're in red there. Across from Canyon Crest, you can see, yes, this is the 1.3 approximately acre area, and you can see by the size of the other lots around that area that they range in around the 2.5 acre size. Our project, I think, meets all requirements that I'm aware of, at least. We have two existing homes on our property. We're long-term Arroyo Grande residents. We've been struggling with this process for 7 years, most of which had to do with trying to convert that that well-sharing agreement into a state small water system. And we ran into a big block way down the line after we spent all the money with the engineering of the water system, et cetera, and working with the county on that, when we came up against the 90,000-gallon tank requirement. And one of our four partners in that well-sharing agreement, that's where our existing tank was on his property, a small 10,000-gallon tank. And as we were doing this, he was working with his architect to develop his retirement home on his lot there. And at some point, it became apparent that the new tank not only was an eyesore for him, but would be sitting on top of his guest house. So that became an impossibility for him. And that really stopped us dead in our tracks after, I think, about 5 years of working on this. And then we heard about OCSDs having this unallocated water, and we started talking about this process. The water wheeling agreements that we developed meet the public water system specification on our track map, and that has to do with the community water system, or the public water system as it's referred to. Our requirements are not that it be a state small water system, but it be a public system, and both the state small and the water wheeling arrangement meet that requirement. And our subdivision includes a variety of other conditions, including water conservation and no secondary structures. It is consistent and conforms with existing land use, as I tried to indicate on those maps. And it meets all the requirements of the Rio Grande water wheeling policy as it stands now. And it does not conflict with Arroyo Grande land use, as I read it, at least in the general plan. I think it's LU 1-1 refers to expanding and creating new residential suburban classified areas. Our project neither expands nor creates a new area. It is simply in one. And at 2.5 acres parcels, our project is entirely consistent with L1-2 as well. Next. This is a copy of our project map with an overlay indicating the division between the existing structures and the proposed layout and building envelopes, which are limited by topography and also by the county. There's it doesn't show here, but in another, there's a line across here that prohibits any building in this area, which is a bit of a creek bed and a steep hill on the side over here. Okay. Now, another, I think, perhaps maybe the most important point is that the question of whether the water wheeling agreement sets a precedent for new growth, and we obviously believe it does not. Perhaps the most important reason for that is that OCSD has changed its policy to exclude future water wheeling outside its jurisdiction after our project. The new policy precludes further water wheeling, and for that reason, I think our project cannot induce further such applications. The water is somewhere it came up that it was referred to as city supplied, and I wanted to make clear that, as I think it's already been made probably, that it's not city water, it's state supplied, allocated to OCSD, and wheeled through Arroyo Grande, we hope. So our project does not stimulate further growth in the area. And if you think about that map again, there are no other the fringe area is built out to the existing lot size requirements, with a couple of exceptions, and the largest one is the Gracia property across the street from us, which is I think 44 acres, but it is on Corbett Canyon, where you punch a well anywhere you want and you get a really good water supply. In fact, that well sharing agreement is for a well on Corbett Canyon, some 3,000 feet from our property. So there's just that lot, which would have its own water, and the Bott property, which is up the road from ours and does not comply with, or will not comply with, the new Arroyo Grande policy, and would be excluded from OCSD's water wheeling since they've stopped doing that. And as was mentioned, the Botts are working on an arrangement with Circle 2, which is at the far end of Stagecoach, with those remaining shares. Next one. I think we've probably gone over some of this. I've just found out that the agreement's been going back and forth between staff, and I think OCSD just sent back to Don Spagnolo, and I don't know whether he's actually looked at it again or not, but it's well on its way to being completed. And LAFCO has approved it as it stands. The other question that came up was, how often does the state shut down the water for flow maintenance, water flow for maintenance? And we found out it's once a year, and that it can range from a couple of days to weeks. Now, because this is all going to be metered, any usage that occurred during that shutdown would be documented and accounted for, and we'd simply the water would be wheeled, in other words. In addition to that, we maintain, or our project is going to have 3,500 to 4,000 gallon tanks on each site, and we retain our one share in that four partner well sharing agreement. We look at it as backup. Okay. Now we get to the idea that the mayor brought up, that there may be another system up there, and we tracked it down. And actually, when Mayor Farrar mentioned that, I immediately thought, ask Terry, and I immediately thought at Circle 2, because I knew that was a system he developed up there years ago, and that turned out to be the one. And as you heard, that is being, Terry, in fact, is proposing to Circle 2 that those shares be allocated to the Botts. We could not find any collapsed well. Nobody knew of it. We canvassed all up Stagecoach and down Paloma, which is the street that goes from Stagecoach down to Cobra Canyon, which is pretty well built out now, too. So we've run out of, and also I think it was county health that was, you asked them, right? Yeah. And they didn't know of any other well either. So that leaves us with this water wheeling agreement as our final option. Okay. In summary, an existing threat, as we've discussed in previous hearings, to public safety exists and continue will to exist in terms of fire protection without the approval of this request. OCSD has unused water and is committed to providing it, and the project is our only option. Existing, and it's interesting, actually, a little aside, when I was many years ago, 25 or more years ago, actually beginning to build. That's when Randy put that big water main in there, and I looked at that. I was drilling on my land at that time looking for water. Anyway, I think I've covered these. I don't need to go on with repeating them, I guess.
Okay.
Any questions?
I just want to make a couple of quick comments, and then I do have a question focused on the presentation. The the whole issue of the collapsed well, and that was part of the story of the information that I got, and the version of the story was kind of relayed to me was that the water did there was insufficient water on an existing parcel up in your area somewhere. Obviously, you didn't find it, but the source of the water did come from a well from a lot that was purchased on Corbett Canyon. And the pipeline was, in fact, run at least a half a mile back up to these parcels. So that was the potential. If you could find whoever was connected to that pipeline and look at the volume of that well, would it be possible to tap into that supply? That was where that came from. And the other one was the Circle 2, obviously.
That almost sounds like our... well, except that ours hasn't collapsed. That is our partner's well, the four. And there was a collapsed well in over on the other side. What's the name of the development? Country Hills Development. Many years ago, probably 10 or more years ago, they had a well, and it was on the Cooper's property, and there was a dispute over drilling another one. It was a big mess, but they finally got it resolved with a new well.
Okay.
But that's all I know.
Okay. The other clarification, and maybe this is for staff, and we've covered this before, but I need a refresher here just to make sure. The one of the bullet points on Mr. Christie's presentation, the water is not, quote, city-supplied, it is state-supplied, allocated to OCSD, sold to the Christie's by Wheeling through Arroyo Grande. I think we've talked about this before. There's no amount of water that goes into our system that has a unique label of state water. Water is water. It's mixed in with the system. What happens, obviously, is that we put state water in one end of our system, and whatever mixture of water, groundwater or Lopez or whatever, comes out the other end, and it's municipal water. Correct? Okay. My concern here is isn't so much the maintenance, and this gets back to the nature of the contract I think that you have worked out with Oceano, and I'm not sure how much you know that you're willing to share, but it appears to me that there needs to be some form of contingency. The annual maintenance is not of concern to me, but a severe drought is. And if you look at, and Terry, I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, the DWR, and I've mentioned it before, they have some fairly strong latitude and discretion in terms of what they do with the coastal reach of state water. They can shut us down if the population centers are in need, what they determine to be population centers. And when that happens, then the allocation to Oceano and anyone else who contracts for state water is not a sure thing. It's not certain. So I guess the question is, what contingency do we have in place if, for one reason or another, in a severe drought, Oceano does not get its allocation? What happens to this agreement? And if we base fire protection on it, what happens to it? Is this going to be a communal presentation?
We're drawing straws for this one.
Okay.
I got the short straw again.
I haven't seen the agreement, and that'll be regulated by the agreement itself. I went through the agreement that we had on a previous water wheeling transaction, and it didn't really deal with that contingency because it was a Lopez-generated agreement. They're outside Zone 3, so they can't have Lopez water. We'll just have to be absolutely certain to protect the city's interests. You know, I don't know how they dealt with that contingency. We have a slight problem there, and I think we talked about this at one of the other hearings where we addressed this issue, and that is, Lopez water can't be served to this property. So that leaves groundwater, at least from our perspective. And we'll just have to deal with it within the agreement itself. I know we have a very strong indemnification provision, and that's really what I'm looking for from the city's perspective. But I can't answer what happens when they shut it off. I presume there'll be an alternative water supply, whether that's Lopez or groundwater, how we get the groundwater through those pipes. That's way beyond my knowledge level. It's a very good question, and I think we can only be certain to cross our T's and dot our I's in the agreement itself to make sure the city's not creating any liability for itself.
Okay, I'm not so much concerned about it from a liability standpoint as I am from a supply standpoint, because in a severe drought, clearly our first priority will be our citizens and determining where we, you know, where we get the water. So I guess what happens to the other end of the pipe in that situation? If Oceano all of a sudden says to you folks, sorry, our state allocation has been reallocated beyond our control. So I'm not saying this to obstruct this. It's a question that I think we have to deal with. What happens if our water from Oceano is shut off on the front end, and what comes out the other end?
And I think that's why it's advisable that they're maintaining a share in that water company for emergency purposes. I think that's just what we're talking about here. And each, as I understand it, each of the lots are going to have a separate 4,000-gallon tank. In theory, that can get them through short periods of shutdown, and I think that's normally what's envisioned. We're only going to wheel water that comes from Oceano. We're not going to be supplying water, and that the agreement is very clear on that issue. So I suspect what really happens if Oceano can't produce that water for whatever reason is that no water comes out of the pipe, and they're forced to deal on site with their water issues.
Okay. Any other questions of staff at this time?
Mr. Mayor.
Or Mr.
I actually had one question for clarification from Mr. Christie. We talk about the well sharing agreement that you currently have one share out of four shares for this well. Are the bots part of that?
Yes.
They have one. But they won't need one after they can you negotiate with the bots to get theirs if they won't need theirs? Without an amendment to the condition of approval.
If I understand correctly, as to the requirements of a well-sharing agreement, each share is, I guess the word would be, pertinent to a given parcel. We have one, they have one, and two others.
You're going to have four parcels pretty quick here.
No, there are four. Well, we would still only have one share.
Not if you bought another one from the bots.
The thought never came to us, and we've never talked about it.
Right.
I don't know how that would all. Of course, even if that were possible, that would depend on their developing their water adequately from the other source.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you want to add something? You have to come to the podium.
Yeah, unfortunately, the idea
of... And state your name, please.
My name is Cindy Christie.
Thanks.
Hello. It's nice to see all of you again. The fact that our land is not adjacent to the bots could create problems with trying to purchase their share with our bylaws with the water company. But in addition to that, they may choose to hold on to that as a backup, as we are choosing to hold on to ours as a backup because of any possible future issues. I think it's probably a wise move for anybody in a high you know, high fire area to have a backup of some sort, and I'm sure they probably feel the same way. I have a statement both from myself, and I have also a statement from Mitch Cooney from OCSD that he sent to me to read to you guys. He, by the way, I talked to him today, and he informed me that I did. You get my message yet? He sent back the new agreement with the changes that were requested. He sent it to Don Spagnuolo already. He sent it a few days ago, but as we know, Don is out of town, so he probably hasn't had a chance to look at it yet. But I believe that they have made all the changes that were requested. So, okay. The Oceano Community Services District Board of Directors, in an open meeting during a discussion of providing water to outside users, determined that water would be provided only within the district and that a request by an outside user or property owner could only be accommodated after the requesting party had annexed their property into the district. A specific mention of the Christie Project was made, and it was determined that an exception would be made for the Christie Project since it had been in development for such a long period of time, and that the district would honor its commitment to the Christies to provide water to their project under the terms and conditions specified in the agreements with the Christies and the City of Arroyo Grande. Since that board meeting, the district has been approached by several other property owners outside the district requesting water service. Each has been informed that the water would be provided only after annexation. Basically, he's just letting you know that this is an official policy of theirs now, and he's sorry he couldn't be here to tell you that himself, but they are honoring ours, but we are the end of the line as far as they're concerned. I know you already knew that, but I thought you'd like to hear it from him specifically. Now, this is my, and I'm nervous, so you guys be patient with me, okay? I want to thank all of you for all the time you've taken with me on the phone and, you know, at the meetings and listening to us. You guys, I really appreciate all of that. I think by now you all know that we're not commercial developers. We're a family who have been long-term residents here in Arroyo Grande, 25 years. A big issue that has been brought up is the sphere of influence, and I understand that technically we're not part of the sphere of influence, but we are in every other way part of the sphere of community. We have lived in this community for 25 years. We have been contributing members of this community. I have been involved with People's Kitchen for many, many years. My mother-in-law, before she lost her vision, was involved with the literacy program. My husband and I both are members of the Preserve the Village Committee. We both were involved in restoring the Bennett House with the previous owner, spent many, 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 many hours scraping and painting and cleaning. And I don't know if you all remember, but a few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the Bennett House was on the Christmas historical tour. Well, I was the decorator. So we are proud to be a part of this community. We have been actively involved for so long, and this is our community. This is where we do everything. This is where we shop. This is where our church is. This is where our friends and our family, you know, everyone is here. This is where we live. So we don't see this as, we've never seen us as being outside of the sphere of influence, although technically we are, we're not outside of the sphere of community. And with everything that we have dealt with this whole project, we have, as you know, come up against many, many, many obstacles, and we have spent a lot of time and all of our savings going through this. As I think you all know, we got involved in this project because my mother-in-law, who was 93 on the 7th of September, she, 7 years ago, wanted to sell her house, which is on our land. She was going blind at the time. She has macular degeneration. She's now in the Wyndham residence, and her care is very expensive. And she has been trying to sell her house for a long time and obviously cannot do that until this project is completed. That has been our impetus for this project from day one, is to get that done so that she can be financially secure and her care can be taken care of. I know it's, I mean, it sounds like not that big of an issue, but to us it's a very, very big issue. It's a family situation that we need to resolve, and that's what we're trying to do here. Let me see what else I wanted to tell you. Like I said, I'm nervous. I'm not very good at speaking up in front of people, so microphones really scare me. But for the last 7 years, we've been doing everything literally. We have met every obstacle, and just so you know, see these binders here? These are my binders. for the last 7 years, water company and subdivision. So I wanted to let you know that this was not a shortcut. This is not an easy way for us to get what we want. This has been a torturous, long journey for us, and what you are is our last hope. You're our community. You're our town, and we're coming to you for your help because we don't have any place else to go. We have exhausted every other means that we had. So we're hoping that you guys will understand our quest and will back us up and support us in your decision. So thank you again for your time, and I appreciate very much your consideration.
Thank you. Anyone else like to add anything to 10A? If you would, please, come to the podium.
Hi, my name is Mike Miller. I live at 387 Corbett Canyon Road. And I'm a long-term friend of the Botts, who, as you know, are intimately involved in this whole process. They have gone through the same arduous process with the Christies for these many years and are in the same position. Satine, who is a resident of Royal Grande and has been for a long time but is currently working in Washington, D.C., couldn't be here this evening. His wife, Shalini, is here, and he asked me to just bring up a couple of points in his behalf. I'm not nearly as familiar with this whole situation, a complex situation, as everyone else here, but he's worked with the Christies right up until the time of their application, worked with Mr. Orton on all these water issues. And just a couple of things that he asked me to bring to your attention. With regard to the Circle 2 water, that issue remains unresolved at this time. Still don't know what's going to happen with that. They're continuing to pursue that. And if they're able to get the shares from Circle 2, it's my understanding that there still remains the issue of water for fire protection. And I know there's been discussion about future city policy with regard to water in that area, and he just asked me to convey that he would hope that you would leave the door open to his coming in and being able to satisfy the water requirements for his lot as well. Specifically, he asked about the possibility of extending the water in the area for fire up to his property, which he said he would be willing to pay for, but at least have the ability to do that in the future. So I believe that's all that he wanted me to bring to your attention, but if there are any of the questions that I can answer, I'll try. But anyhow, I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. Anyone else? Okay. We're going to bring this back to the council. And Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start us off here?
Okay. Well, we have actually already considered this once in the past and continued hoping to find an alternative solution here. I can share your frustration with having to go through what is a very arduous process. It is, in fact, an arduous process because it's difficult to do. There's limited infrastructure available in the fringe area for the development that the county has already zoned for. In fact, our policy actually reads that the city requests that the county amend its land use element to reduce residential and rural residential suburban land uses in the fringe areas. We're actually looking for reductions, not just continuing on with the zoning that's there. I think and I certainly can't speak for the county planning department or the county planning commission, but I think that the reason that the requirement is here for the upgraded water service, the California Water Service, is that in the past, well agreements haven't been sufficient, that there's been well failures, that there's been water quality failures. Canyon Crest is a good example of this. There was an approved project, had plenty of water, and then all of a sudden it wasn't there. So what I think what the county was looking for when they made this kind of requirement is they're looking for the complete development of a water source. And it's really in everyone's interest that alternative water sources, not just state water, not just the fact that Oceano today has extra water, in fact gets redistributed to other areas. I think you're seeing that the fact that OCSD is now reconsidering this policy and in the future won't be offering this kind of a service demonstrates that this was probably a bad idea from the beginning. So I think it's very much in the city's interest, very much in the county's interest, very much in our community's interest that other water sources are developed. And if there's the potential here, if in fact this well has the capacity, we should be encouraging the development of it into a California, either this or some other source. There may be possibilities of working with the county with developing the two parcels and leaving the remaining parcels with some sort of agreement that in fact down the road. But that's for the county. Down the road would be developed when, in fact, the water was developed. So I still wouldn't be in favor of wheeling the water here. I don't accept in an very emergency situation. I don't think it's a good idea. As for the fire protection, I think in general, and this is someone outside of this, is that we should be looking at designing with the county's help a fire protection. If it involves using city water when there's a fire, then so be it. But we should be looking at in the future, if we're going to have to fight these fires, that the county should fund, or somebody should fund, in fact, to provide the infrastructure to fight these fires, independent of any development, independent of providing any domestic water. If city's water is available to do that, then the fire department should have that water available to fight those fires. But that's really separate from this. So going forward, I still think it's in everybody's interest that, in fact, a separate water system is developed, and that in fact we don't. If we're going to say that we're not going to do it in the future, then certainly we shouldn't be doing it today either. Things change. Things may change where in the future it is in our interest to do it. But clearly, if it's not in our interest today, if it's not our interest in the future, then it's not our interest today. So as much as I'd like to help the Christies out with this, I really think there has to be another alternative developed for the subdivision of this parcel. Thanks.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
All right. Well, my viewpoint hasn't changed either. I do think that the city gets a benefit with the fire hydrant out there. I think the fact that OCSD has changed their policy, I think really for the bats, it's really not an option anymore for them. While they may like to see the door kept open for them, I would be willing to look at the fire extension if they were willing to pay for it, but from a water supply standpoint, it does not appear that is an option anymore for them. So therefore, I think the city changing the policy going forward would be appropriate. I think this boils down to just a fairness issue, and I don't see our policy being violated by wheeling the water. We may have a loophole that we do want to close, so we can do that, but from a fairness, I think to supply the water is appropriate. I think that the city needs to make sure that we are protected so that if the Oceano would stop supplying you with water, then that would be a different issue. Then you'd have to start looking for another source. But then they're going to have that problem with everybody they're providing water to. So since you'd be under contract, I don't want to see the Arroyo Grande on the hook for your water, but as far as supplying the pipes, I don't have a problem with this, so I will be supporting tonight. Thank you.
Thanks. Councilmember Dickens?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I've had a difficult time with this since the beginning, and the problem that I have with it is that it's wrought with a lot of complications. My biggest problem is that I see that we're providing municipal services, whether it's the city of Arroyo Grande or whether it's Oceano Community Services, to county residents. And if the time were to ever come, and if this property were to develop to 2, 3, 4 lots as it's proposed, and the state was to cut off those resources, we would be obligated to shut off the valve. And what I perceive at that point is there's going to be 4 residents, whether it's you still living there 25 years from now, who's living there, that we're going to be in a lawsuit. And it's going to cost the citizens of Arroyo Grande thousands of dollars, in my opinion, to shut the water off. even though it's not our agreement. And we can argue till the cows come home that this isn't our water and it's state water, but the city of Arroyo Grande is the one that's going to be probably taken to task. And I really have a hard time with this. I agree with Councilmember Guthrie. I think the reason why the county is being stringent is because there are serious issues with water use and well sharing, and that there needs to be more of a reliable long-term source of water that's available to these outlying areas. Our responsibility here with the city of Arroyo Grande is certainly with the citizens, and I understand that you both feel and you should be a part of this community, and yet you're not within the city limits, and we have an obligation for that. It's apparent to me that there's not enough water and or water storage in this area to accommodate the proposed subdivision densities that were coming forth. Council Member Arnold talked about fairness. I would have a hard time saying fair to Christie's and not fair to the Botts. And I think that we're placed in a very awkward position. I don't like this position when it comes to looking at situations that are affecting your lives. But ultimately, my responsibility is to the folks who elected us here, and that I have to maintain good, prudent fiscal responsibility and good, prudent land use planning. I fundamentally have difficulties with a policy of providing municipal services to outlying areas. And I believe, to me, that's why I didn't support Canyon Crest, even though I knew they were in dire straits, and I don't support this evening. Unfortunately, we are broken up into jurisdictions, and the jurisdiction that you need to be working with is the county. I believe there are other options here. They may not be the best options, and it comes down to what's good for you, what's good for the Botts, and developing these properties appropriately is something you'll need to deal with the county. I believe that those conditions can be amended. I think you'll need to go back to that process and look at it. From my standpoint, we have the Circle 2 community water service up there that appears to have at least six shares. If the Botts get the four, good for them. They're still working out that agreement. That remains two more for you all, and in the well that's there, then can be worked on. It's unfortunate that we're placed in this situation, but I have to go back to, regardless of whether this is four homes or whether it's 400 homes, the policy is the same. We have an obligation to provide municipal services to the citizens of Arroyo Grande. And I see this being an ongoing problem, not just today, but into the future, that it's not appropriate land use planning when we take water that's over in the ocean and wheeling it, five, six, 7 miles someplace else through another municipality. Is, to me, it's really a shell game, and I don't think it's appropriate land use planning. So with that, I would have to deny the request. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I wasn't here the first time around on this, so I got to get all the information fairly recently and go through it all. My biggest concerns were to ensure that the city was protected and that we were following policies that existed. And it seems fairly clear to me that the existing policy in the city does not prohibit this agreement. The loophole that exists is going to be closed, whether we give you this agreement or not, whether we approve this or not, we're going to close that loophole. But at this point, I've got no objections to complying with your request and approving the water wheeling agreement. Provided, and I'm seem to hear from the, our attorney that we do have sufficient indemnification in this, and that you have no rights to our water from this. We're simply agreeing to wheel the water, and I have no problem with that.
Water is a problem in this community, in this county. It's going to continue to be a problem. It's going to get worse. But you've solved your problem in terms of coming to agreement with the OCSD. You may have a problem down line if a drought comes up, a 2 or 3 year drought, and the water is not available. It's not going to be flowing through the pipe, and it's not going to be coming from us, and then it's going to become your problem again to find a source of water at that time. I think that it's a good thing that we get the fire additional fire protection up there right now. I kind of agree with Mr. Guthrie that we do need to look at longer-term firefighting capabilities and come up with some more permanent solutions. All that said, like I say, I have no problem with approving the water wheeling agreement and with modifying your city policy regarding the water wheeling agreements for future requests, with the understanding that Oceano is not going to be providing water for anyone else. The bots may have to come back, and we may have some sort of leeway where we can talk about firefighting, but I think they have to understand that they're not going to be able to get any water for residential usage from this type of an agreement with us. That's my position. I can't support this, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Thanks. Guess it comes down to me, huh? Councilmember Dickens raised a point, Tim, with regard to liability, and I need some clarification here. If the scenario materializes that I described earlier when we talk about what comes into the pipe and the fact that if it stops coming into the pipe, the spigot shuts off at the other end, which would mean at the Christie's location. Given that, given the fact that, you know, what we're essentially talking about is potentially a public safety, but certainly a public health issue. If they're relying on our water source, can a contractual agreement address sufficiently the fact that we would actually do that in terms of liability?
Yes, it can, and it does. And they're not relying on our water source; they're relying on the district's, on Oceano Community Services District's water. And our agreement is with Oceano. We don't have an agreement per se with the Christie family. It's only with Oceano. So that's of paramount importance to me, too. And, yes, I do believe we can close that particular liability.
Okay. All right. You know, my concern here is that I'm talking, you know, to the Christie family. If you went ahead and developed as you indicate that you would, given the contingencies here, that you would begin to rely on us as a primary source. And I guess my admonishment to you at this point would be that you probably shouldn't do that. You probably should continue to at least strongly consider the potential that this source could be shut off at some point in the future. And in terms of liability, and I'm not an attorney, but I suspect that if you were to subdivide and you had four units and you had families who lived there, and all of a sudden their water was shut off for the reasons that we've indicated here. I'm certain that perhaps some of the liability would attach back to Oceano, or at least there would be an attempt at that. But I also feel that some of that liability would attach to you. And that's something that you have to be prepared for, because I agree with Councilmember Dickens that our first consideration, particularly in a drought situation, would be our own citizens who are required to do that. So I'm going to be looking very cautiously to ensure that this agreement, however it's crafted, considers everything that we have discussed tonight. And In terms of using our infrastructure to transport in this particular situation, I'm not going to oppose this. I will go ahead and support this with the modification to our policies that this pretty much is it. And also with a strong admonishment, and you have to, from a planning standpoint, you have to understand this. That spigot is going to be shut off if Oceano decides to stop supplying, and that's not going to leave you in a good position up there. It's not from a planning standpoint. I would not want to be in your position if that happens. So that's something that, I would strongly admonish some means of securing an auxiliary or a backup source. If that backup source is successful at some point, and I'm not certain at whether we, can seek out some form of a sunset or some measure like that, I don't know. To me, there may be structured into the agreement should be some motivation for the Christies to continue to aggressively seek an alternative source. And if that source is located, then maybe we revisit this, this whole agreement that we have. But again, with those provisions, I don't have an issue going ahead and supporting this agreement.
Mr. Mayor, can I ask Tim a question?
Sure.
Could we ask them to add a deed restriction to the new parcels stating specifically that Arroyo Grande is not providing water to the parcels but is only providing pipeline capacity? So that there be no ambiguity, as far as the fact that we are not a water provider. I think what the mayor is trying to say, everybody's concern here, is that we don't believe the Christies are going to sue us, but who ends up with the parcels down the road may not fully be aware of where the water is coming from. Would that be a reasonable?
I think it's an excellent idea to provide some written notice.
I think it should be part of disclosure.
That's recorded.
In whatever transactions occur, that we are not a water provider. We are simply a transporter. And I think that needs to be made abundantly clear in any real estate agreements or transactions. That's a good idea.
Okay. Ready for motion?
Any other questions, comments? Then, yes, I will entertain a motion.
Okay. I didn't see a prepared motion in here, so I'm going to make this up. I'd like to propose a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande approving the water wheeling agreement with the Oceano Community Service District for the Christie Family Subdivision, and with the caveat that there will be deed restrictions placed on all new lots created, stating that the City of Arroyo Grande is not providing water to the parcels, but is only providing the pipeline capacity or the wheeling of the Oceano water. I'm going to propose as a second resolution the adoption of the new policy so that we can all vote on that one then.
Okay.
I'll second that.
We do that in one or two motions? You want two?
Two second motions.
Okay. All right, then we have a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Discussion, please.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm sorry. I asked you before, and you didn't have anything else to add.
No, before, but now after the motion.
Oh, okay. All right.
In the motion, you specifically talked about all new lots that were created. I think it's imperative that the deed restriction is placed on all lots.
Okay. Yes, I would.
Regardless of whether they're new or old.
And it's acceptable to me.
Okay. Anything? Any other discussion on the motion? Okay. Roll call.
I have to stick my nose in again. Just to clarify, there's no resolution, and it's a water wheeling agreement that's an agreement in a form approved by me because it's not approved by the city attorney because it's not actually in the packet right now. So I just wanted to clarify that.
The final wording is going to come back to us, I hope.
As it's structured now, no, but we could certainly restructure it so that the final agreement comes back to the council formally on the consent agenda or otherwise.
I think a consent item, at least it'd give us a chance to take a look at it and have a final chop. And consent's fine. We can pull it if we have an issue with it. If not, it goes right through. If that's okay with the motion maker.
We'll modify again.
And the second.
And I accept the modification.
Okay. Thank you. All right. With that adjustment, is there any other discussion? Okay. Roll call.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
No.
Councilmember Guthrie?
No.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
Okay. So now, is this going to be a resolution or not for the next item either?
Yes.
I don't think it's a resolution.
No, it's not a resolution.
Okay. So then I'm just going to propose approval of the City Council of El Royo Grande approving changes to the city's policy regarding water wheeling agreements as specified in this document. Is that sufficient?
For future requests.
For future requests.
Okay.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on this motion? Okay. Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. All right, that will take us to new business. 11A, consideration of procedures for enforcement of illegal garage conversions.
Where's Exhibit A?
Mayor Ferrara, members of the City Council, good evening. As a matter of introduction, I'd like to point out that this evening John and Sola Beher, our former interim former interim neighborhood services coordinator came back to help us present this program to you this evening. John has left. He was stolen away from us by our city attorney's office and is currently working with the city attorney. We now have two gentlemen from the Fire and Emergency Services Division that are performing the duties of John as neighborhood services coordinators. So I'm going to turn this over to you. John has prepared this entire staff report, and we'll explain the program to you.
Before John begins, that kind of behavior is just totally uncalled for.
This is his punishment.
Any form of punitive action against a city attorney?
I was fined substantially at several city staff meetings. And I'd like to point out that the firm of Carmel and Nakasha paid for preparation of the staff report and for John's time associated with this item.
Okay. You're suggesting that's sufficient?
Okay. Could I ask, does that mean that the firm is also responsible for Exhibit A not being enclosed in the packet?
No. We simply allowed him the time to prepare the exhibits. We didn't do any of the work ourselves.
Well, they didn't want to pay for Exhibit A.
I blame any mistakes on FEBIC in this particular report.
Does this mean the council might want to reschedule the city attorney's evaluation that took place a couple weeks ago?
Well, I noticed this occurred since his evaluation, so... Yeah, but there's always next year.
May we proceed, Mr. Mayor?
Yes, go right ahead. Sorry about
that.
As directed, staff has researched the issue of illegal garage conversions in secondary units. Tonight, staff would like to briefly discuss this issue and provide council with a recommendation to address the issue. Garage conversions in secondary units can offer homeowners a viable option to increase living space or supplement their income. However, through staff research and investigation, staff has identified a substantial amount of illegally constructed garage conversions in secondary residential dwellings. Currently, a garage conversion or secondary residential dwelling may be permitted so long as the conversion conforms to all development code and building code requirements. However, illegally constructed garage conversions and secondary units pose threats to the health and safety of the residents as well as the community for many reasons. For instance, when the fire department responds to a fire, the garage is often the last place that will be searched if not known to be a habitable unit, and consequently, since the work is constructed without benefit of permit, proper construction layout standards may not have been followed and such structures have not been inspected. Life-threatening issues such as proper ingress, egress, light and ventilation, proper electrical layout may not have been abided by, and in some of the most egregious cases, water heaters or other combustible materials may be located in the same area where someone sleeps. And additionally, garage conversions often displace needed parking and storage. However, laws related to illegal construction is both difficult and time-consuming to enforce. Many illegal conversions or secondary units go unnoticed and transfer owners. Most times, the amount of investment completed by the homeowner makes it unlikely to resolve these violations on a voluntary basis and creates an adversarial relationship with the city. And additionally, to pursue abatement of the estimated number of illegal dwellings, it would not be feasible given the city's resources and would create a substantial negative public relation. The city's current enforcement method for these structures is complaint-driven, utilizing the current code enforcement process and citation or abatement enforcement. This process is intended to be a case-by-case strategy. As with all neighborhood service issues, staff's approach would be to assist the property owner in determining how best to meet compliance, given the existing situation. A number of steps and options are proposed to be offered to the property owners. First, the property owner would be required to permit the structure through a building permit. Second, under some circumstances, the property owner may apply for a minor use permit for the conversion or dwelling, which may reduce the parking requirement or setback requirement. However, many conversions and dwellings would not be applicable to be permitted through such a process. And third, if a minor use permit was denied under certain circumstances, it is proposed that staff have the option to utilize a notice of violation process as defined in the California Health and Safety Code Section 17985 as a supplementary process to the current code enforcement process. The notice of violation would be recorded against the title of the subject property and would indicate that the particular structure on the property is in violation of the Rio Grande Municipal Code, and a pending investigation exists against the property. The recorded document would then appear on the property title and result in the disclosure of such violations upon any transfer of the property. By using this process, illegal garage conversions and secondary units would be deemed safe for human habitation due to issuance of a building permit. Needed living space or supplemental income would not be eliminated, and development code violations would also not be ignored, and the overall disclosure of municipal code violations would be increased. The primary focus of the strategy is to maintain and or increase the safety and well-being of the residents by allowing issuance of building permits, even though development code violations exist on the subject.
For it, or are we going to continue to try to eventually have them remove this? I'm not sure how that ever gets resolved, or is it just a notice to any future buyers that this property is substandard? Is that more what we're really trying to accomplish?
A couple things. One additional thing we wanted to recommend is some ability still under certain circumstances. For example, if there were an issue on a case that had significant neighborhood, if we determined there was a significant impact on the neighborhood due to a parking issue or so forth, that we would still have the ability to require a full removal of the unit. In other cases, we've been trying to develop a strategy that addresses the primary issue or concern, which is health and public safety, try to get those building code violations rectified. Do it in a way where we would not allow the other units. We wouldn't be permitting we wouldn't be saying that the unit is legal or is permitted under the development code regulations, but avoid instantly having to require them to tear out all the construction, because we think from both public relations standpoint and just from a staffing standpoint, the workload in doing that, given the number of cases we think we're facing, is not going to be realistic. So yes, really what you said is probably the most accurate, is we're hoping, we record that on the title, and hopefully when they go to sell that unit, the title company or the mortgage company would require that be rectified as part of the sale.
But if there were no penalties associated with having the illegal unit, I mean, I've seen properties where they'll specifically advertise, you know, X, Y, and Z is not a permitted structure, and everybody knows it, and except for the city, because they're not calling up the city and saying, hey, we're selling this with an illegal garage conversion, and I'm not sure that it has any impact. So I guess one of the concerns that I have is when we just say if it has an impact on the neighborhood as far as parking goes, are we going to try to define what that means? Because I thought we wouldn't have these parking requirements in our code if we didn't think they were actually important. This is where I'm really concerned with how this actually is going to be implemented. And are we going to also then be looking at grandfathering so that starting today you can't, if someone comes in and says we want to do a garage conversion, you say you can't, you don't have the parking, well then they do it illegally, and they come in and say, okay, I've got an illegal garage conversion, now go ahead and put a notice on my deed, I'm happy with that. These are issues that I'm seeing. I know this is messy, and that's why there's no real good way to deal with this, and I was hoping you'd have a magic wand that you were going to come up and I'm not seeing the magic wand.
Well, part of this process is to increase more proactive enforcement. So one of the abilities to try to reduce or have a disincentive for folks going out and doing that is we're going to be out there watching. And if someone's caught doing the illegal construction, they would be required to be eliminated immediately.
So, but are we going to actually have a grandfather so that we're going to say, going forward from today, we're not going to tolerate this anymore? And so if you convert it, if you do a conversion tomorrow, you know, even if you would be able to have made the findings, I guess we'll say, to not have it tore out, but because you did it after this new policy, we're not going to? Because I understand trying to not create bad will with all the people that have it and people who have bought it and spent the money, but if we're almost making a policy now where we're really kind of saying there's a loophole for getting around our guidelines, that's what I'm kind of afraid of right now. We're almost saying you can do it and you won't get in trouble. If you get caught doing it, you will, but so you keep the garage door down, you do it, which is the problem with the garage conversions, I think, is that it's really easy to do it without anybody seeing it.
We'll jump in, but I don't define this as somebody not getting in trouble. One, they're going to have to bring it up to building code. That's not always going to be easy. One, they got this information on their title that's going to cause them problems down the road. It's hard to, having some kind of grandfather is something we could entertain, but we hadn't proposed it because we really don't know the units that we come across. We're not sure when they were constructed in many cases.
And I realize that sometimes you're not going to be able to tell, but I think in other cases it may be very apparent. So there may be some that are going to slip through the cracks. Some are going to slip through anyways. Are we going to try to define what a parking impact is?
Yes, we would want to do that.
To look forward to doing something like that is possibly add the low flow also, since right now we're kind of asking people to do it, but there's really no way to have any kind of proof that it's been done. If we're going to be sending somebody out to the house, that's an easy enough one to check too. So I suggest that we add that to that alternative if we go forward with that. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Any other questions of John or Steve or Terry?
Can I just ask, what other city has used a similar program where they enforce the safety issues but not the...
I believe this one was from Sunnyvale. The city of Sunnyvale, or Daly City, one of those two.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess I'm going back to some of the same type of questions that Ed was asking. If we go through the first and second and third stages in this process, the minor use permit's been denied, and we issue a notice violation. And there's still no further compliance at that time. And the people say, well, we're not moving, we're not selling for who knows how long. And then there's a fire and there's loss of life. Are we liable?
One of the things that I believe that we've got as an additional tool is our citation program that we've come up with, and that would be one of the things. If we did not get the compliance from the people, our intention, this whole program is really built around safety, Mayor Pro Tem. It is built around the safety that we feel is compromised by people building something that does not potentially have proper ingress egress, that encloses water heaters and forced air units in the same room that someone is sleeping in, that has been disguised, that does not have windows on it. The electrical stuff in there might not be compliant. And that is why we have focused on this program, is because of that great safety concern. If they do not make the steps, and I think what you're saying is if they basically just totally ignore every overture that we make to them, am I correct in assuming that?
Yes.
Then what is our step? And our step would be the citation program. And I would refer back to the city attorney who helped us develop that program and could certainly confirm the application of that and the appropriateness of the application of that.
So how would the citation portion of that work then?
I look at it a little bit differently. I look at this as a tracking, sort of a deferral and tracking mechanism, the notice of violations. If we had the resources to tackle all the problems, we would. And that's why I think we're prioritizing real health and safety issues and dealing with them. Those that we feel are not necessarily imminent health and safety issues, we file notice of violations and track them with sort of a hope and a prayer that on their own volition, perhaps as a part of a sale or otherwise, they're going to make those repairs themselves. But the citation program, and I'm not sure how it fits in with the notice of violation, is just a straight citation program. It forces them into court to deal specifically with the violation, and it's abated through the court process. I'm not sure how that fits or what Chief Fiebig had in mind when he made that statement. We can defer back to him. But with regard to the notice of violation and whatever liabilities it may or may not carry, we have a lot of immunities. Cities possess a lot of immunities with regard to this particular issue. But we're going to have to be making some judgment calls with regard to health and safety issues as to what constitutes a real severe health and safety issue that has to be addressed immediately. And the hope is that those get addressed immediately through the normal code enforcement
and the
process.
Means of address would be the citation process.
Through citation or the abatement process. There's a couple of processes we have available, but right now we're utilizing or beginning to utilize the citation process.
So this is not going to be used as a substitute for dealing with the life safety issue?
I don't think it was ever intended to.
I guess that's where the confusion is. We have two sets of regulations that we're trying to reach compliance on. The building and life safety is what we have to have immediate compliance on. That's where the citation process comes in. We issue them a notice. We go through a period of about three notices. We have a procedure in place. If they don't comply within a certain period, then they are cited. Now, when we get through all that process and they bring it up to building code and they are not able to address the development code, zoning code issues, that's when the notice of violation is placed on the residents after the building and life safety issues have been addressed.
Okay, thank you very much.
I had a related question, and I guess I don't have a warm fuzzy yet with this, and I, you know, I'm relying on you to our capability, done all we could do. If something bad happens while we're in the middle of this enforcement process, in other words, is it strong enough?
I believe it's stronger than what we have right now. So yes, I think again, there's going to be some judgment calls involved here. The notice of violations are going to be recorded against properties that, in theory, don't have imminent health and safety violations. Those are going to have to be addressed up front as a part of either the citation procedure or the abatement procedure, whatever it works for that particular circumstance. I think it's once you've corrected the life safety issues, then you're dealing with sort of generic code enforcement issues that I think, normally are sort of dropped off the back end. And that's why I look at the notice of violation as a tracking mechanism. It's going to be there. We're going to have a nice list of them. And in theory, you're not really going to be able to sell a house easily with that notice of violation out there. It's going to be hard to get a mortgage. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to sell because most buyers really aren't interested in buying a problem or buying a lawsuit or buying an abatement. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but it's as aggressive as what we have in place now, and then it adds a sort of a new level that we don't have now. And that, to me, is more of a tracking mechanism than anything else.
And if I could just add to that, I think the purpose of this is to make the building and life safety portion of it very aggressive. I mean, that was why we instituted this citation. So that part of the process we are going to be very aggressive on. It's after that, after we reach the building and life safety compliance, the part we're talking about being a little more lenient on is the development code requirements. Once we've reached building and life safety, then those are the point where we want to try to work out some process where, no, we're not making it legal, no, we're not saying you've gotten away with this, but at the same time, we're not having to go out to every single one of these units and say you got to tear all this stuff out, because that just gets to be unrealistic at a certain point. But as far as the building and life safety, that portion of the process is going to be very aggressive.
Would it help or hinder, somewhere in the framework of this policy, or the, you know, the whatever the process or code is that we're working on here, would it be helpful, or would it work to our disadvantage for us to put in criteria that deals with how we define most egregious, how we define significant greatest threat to public health and safety? In other words, if we were to use those terms and then say such as, and give examples, is that something that other cities have done?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we are, when we say building and life safety, we are requiring them to bring everything up to building code.
Yes, we are.
So I'm not sure we need a definition, because we're all building code requirements are going to be required to be met. Why don't you take that?
Mr. Mayor and members of the council, on page 3 of the staff report, there are several points that are made. I believe that there are 5 different points there that are highlighted as bullet points. And those are going to be, as it says, the most dangerous violations common to the illegal conversions. Not only do those bullet points apply to the garage conversions, but they also apply many times when somebody has taken a room and added it onto the back of their house and has done some of the same things. So I think that if we're looking for definition of egregious, that those are the things that we are going to, that are going to be the trigger points. The other one is raising of the garage door and finding a blank wall immediately behind the garage door with no window or doorway in it that, you know, keeps ingress and egress from that, or prevents us from getting in there as a firefighting crew to try to save someone that's inside of that room. So those are the things, and I again, combined with the building code and fire code violation issues that we're going to be focusing on.
Okay. I see where you're at in the staff report, Terry. This tells a story. But I guess what I'm after is structuring this in such a way that if we're going to put it into procedure and protocol, that it comes out like a guidance document, or it comes out like a directing document, that this is what we're going to do, this is what we're going to be looking for. And we may want to look at those bullet points and craft them a little bit differently.
Those were my.
It's because you're aware of it and then close down the business. And I think that's the kind of judgment and kind of judgment on fire safety issues and public safety issues that take place all the time. And if there was huge liability there, we would be doing nothing but litigation. So I guess that's kind of a comment and kind of a question. But I just said we do these kinds of things already with businesses, and we're now talking about extending them to secondary dwellings and already have extended them to homes. This is really no different than inspecting a home that we do that has a specific life safety issue, that the degree to which we're going to enforce it and say you have to vacate this home or you have to fix it by this certain date, there's always some window in there that would potentially have some liability. This is really no different than any of those things. It's just that we're expecting to find more violations, more safety violations.
Okay. Any other comments? Well, once again, this is not a public hearing. But, Mr. Ross, would you like to chime in on this since you're our public?
Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. I have a couple of real quick observations regarding this. The fire department has the ability to red tag a structure. If they inspected the structure and felt like it was in imminent health and danger, they could red tag it and the structure could not be occupied. That would certainly be one way of expediting anything that needed to be done. As far as restricting the sale of the home, that is actually relatively easy as well, although it does take staff time and effort and to some extent some probably monetary effort as well. You can issue a monetary violation with a fine. If that fine is not removed until the problem is solved, if they don't solve the problem in a given amount of time, 30, 90, 180 days, whatever you so decide, then you could file a lien against the house, which would have to be satisfied prior to the house being sold under title laws. A lot of liens, like a construction lien, has a drop-dead date, and it doesn't stay there forever. I don't know what it might have in this case, but I would assume that it would also have that kind of a date. So at the end of when that date approached, if the problem hadn't been satisfied, then you would then proceed to file against the house in order to get your money out of it. Most of those things are never done because before somebody is going to let you take their house away for the fact of a slight bill, they'll pay the bill. But those are methods that can be used to restrict the title insurance and the deed of the house. They're pretty actively used all the time in the construction industry. I don't see why they couldn't be used here. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments from anyone? If not, we'll bring this back. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I think this definitely, from my perspective, we're dealing with a couple of issues. One, we're trying to balance the health, safety, and general welfare of the community in regards to our housing and illegal construction with time and effort necessary to appropriately deal with these issues. And that's the balance that we're trying to reach. My approach, I guess, would be that I think we're doing a lot of this already. The things that we're proposing this evening, the different steps to help the property owner be compliant, is consistent with our policy of trying to be community friendly, and I think that's the gist of this. my impression is that we're going to have lots of, I mean, we can't just say, you know, this is a garage conversion and this is what it looks like. There's lots of different types of things going on out there. And I would leave that up to the professional judgment of the folks that are out there looking at this on a day-to-day basis, understanding, you know, first and foremost, as the chief has pointed out, the life and safety issues that need to be paramount. We cannot put a price on someone who is living in a substandard situation that is at risk. So I personally, even though I know you're being a little cautious in regards to being community friendly, I think in order for us to be community friendly, we also have to be hold folks accountable. Certainly, the approach that we've come up with the new, I'll call it the new approach to our code violation and code enforcement, which we've gotten rid of, is something that I fully support and know that the folks that are out there doing it are going to make good judgment calls individually, taking a look at each one of these violations and appropriately assessing it. When it comes down to the fact that if we can't get appropriate compliance, I would take it to the next step. And actually, I think we need to do some of the things that Steve Ross has mentioned. I know it's staff time consuming, but again, we can't put a price on life and safety, and I think it's our obligation to do so. So,
Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The clarifications tonight have helped a whole lot, because I must admit when I first started reading this report, I was a little confused on how the third option was going to work. I think this is a very good idea. I've always struggled with how you were going to actually come up with a policy that was going to have our citizens happy and try to come somewhat into compliance with our codes. So now that I understand that basically health and safety is going to be a zero tolerance, and on the guidelines as far as building, as far as the development code, we're going to have a little bit of flexibility, at least on a temporary basis, as I think was really how we can look at this. Long term, we would like to have a zero tolerance on that, but that would not be community friendly. So I can definitely support this. I would like to see us, if we could maybe tighten up some of the language as far as defining, like, as the impact and stuff, and whether that would be just neighborhood complaint or whether, you know, cars are double parked or however we want it, if it's going to be an aesthetic thing or if it's going to be a function of safety. Maybe, again, you're back to if the fire trucks can't even get to the house because there's so many cars in the driveway or whatnot. So I'd like to see that maybe defined a little bit. I would also like to see us go forward with the option of having a certificate of compliance at the sale of a home. I think that would probably be a little bit faster way of seeing that we get some of these health and safety issues dealt with. I'm not sure that I agree that homes that might have this stigma attached to them with a notice of uncompliance and noncompliance might affect the sale of the home. But even if that's not the case, I think that the person buying the home would have full knowledge of what they're actually getting would be useful. So I definitely think that could just be another added feature that we're offering to the city, since we recognize that there may be 450 or more of these out there. The likelihood that some are being sold every day and some of the buyers may not know what they're getting. So I think this is an excellent program, and I definitely support it.
Thanks. Councilmember Guthrie.
I support it as well. I think that, you know, tracking deferral is a good description of this. I think that realizing how big the problem is very important, and it's particularly important that on those that we know of that we can get at least the basic health and safety violations taken care of. I guess I would be a little bit hesitant to leave it exclusively as complaint-driven, and I'm sort of struck by that there's been 9 complaints in 2 years, and there's 450 potential units out there. So I think that, you know, depending on staff time is staff time, but in reality, we really should make it a higher profile than hope someone complains.
Okay.
Yeah, can I respond to that? I think what we're saying is we just want to start. The first priority will be to get the ones that we have on a list that are complaint-driven. Then we want to go to the next step, which is a list we have of those we've identified ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then once we catch up with that, then we want to start developing some strategies of how we can be even more proactive and go out and try to find more of these units.
I do think the deferral, if in fact... You know, we have a whole bunch of people seeing this loophole and developing even more illegal units. As the profile of illegal units rises, so will the public reaction to it. And we're not we then have the list, and we can go out and raise the enforcement level to whatever is appropriate. I do think the sort of the kind of worst offender does probably need some definition, because what's going to happen is the first time this happens, it's somebody's going to come in and scream you're discriminating, because in fact you are singling this particular unit out for some reason. So some sort of criteria for why that takes place. I do think it's important to aware at that time we can add them to our list. We're already doing some sort of certificate for water saving devices, so there has to be, there's already a process in place. So I don't know that it's particularly onerous to add that. I'm not quite sure. Are we going to walk every home? I'm not quite sure how we develop the certificate of compliance, but I do think that's a good idea. It'll make us aware very quickly, and at least have people adjusting it so that maybe you can't tell it's there, but take the kitchen out or whatever. So those are my comments. I think we should move forward with this.
Yeah, the certificate of compliance is a little bit different than what we're doing with the water conservation measures. It would actually require a city inspection. So if that's something the council wants us to look into, I would think we'd want to meet with some of the the people in the real estate community and see how that fits in with their process. I mean, that would be a pretty big job.
Can I ask, does Sunnyvale do that?
I'm sorry?
Sunnyvale or Daly City, the city example, do they actually require an inspection?
Oh, no, not them. They utilize the notice of violation. I believe cities such as, like, Pasadena and a couple other larger cities down south, that they utilize the certificate of compliance.
Those are my comments. Thank you.
Right. Mayor Pro Tem?
I don't have a great deal to add to this. I agree with most of what I'm hearing. I think this is a positive step going forward, and coming up with the notice violation form as a step three works. I think that we must continue to be vigilant and deal with life safety issues rapidly and with some finality. If a life safety issue exists out there, we need to deal with it. And it sounds like we have that process in place. In terms of defining what life safety issues are, I don't know if we need to do that or not. If staff needs to do that, let's go ahead and do it. If the staff doesn't, that's fine. I think that the certificate of compliance program should be investigated. We should talk to the real estate industry. We should see what that would involve. Let's maybe talk to some of the other jurisdictions that have had experience with that, see what they can tell us as to how effective that's been. And we might want to talk to the lending industry and find out just how effective or what real impact a notice of violation is going to make on a property that has a sale that's pending or is in the process of being sold. So, but I like what we're doing. I think it's a positive step, and I can support going forward with bringing in the notice of violation program.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I'm going to come back to, the position that I had a moment ago, and that is that I feel we need to be more definitive. You have at least two circumstances out there right now. You have people who have done the conversion themselves illegally, and they've done it perhaps without the knowledge that, the permitting issue not aside, but what constitutes a hazardous situation versus what doesn't. And I'm sure that there's some folks out there that, have looked at situations much differently than what you would look at them as an enforcement agency out there, a permitting agency looking at them, simply because of an absence of knowledge. In other words, they don't understand that they're creating a life-threatening situation by, not ventilating appropriately or to code or whatever the case may be. The second group of people that you're dealing with, and this gets back to what Councilmember Guthrie was saying
are those folks who have just recently purchased that kind of situation where they had that secondary unit in the back, and now it's there. And how do they deal with it, or do they even deal with it at all? I think what I would like to see here is, and I don't know if we have these things or not, Steve, but if somebody walks into community development right now or building and safety, is there a brochure rack that they can pick up that has a big red font and a warning sign that says, do you have an illegal garage conversion, or something to the effect, if you have one of these, beware, or something that draws the attention to the public. Do we have something like that?
I don't think we have that particular one yet, but a key component of the new Neighborhood Services program has been to develop a number of those type of brochures. We've been focusing on education as one of the key components of the program, so that could be the next brochure.
Well, that's my recommendation, is public education and outreach, and I would strongly recommend that we put out a very explicit description. Do you have these things in your – do you have a secondary unit? If so, do these things exist? And this is where we list those criteria. If they do, here are the consequences, and here's how you can fix it that we have. And, I agree. I think Councilmember Arnold mentioned it. This is sort of a – kind of akin to a progressive discipline approach. We're giving them an opportunity to correct – and as long as we do it, I guess, with a modicum of aggression, so that we get at the good faith threshold that we're doing what we can, then I can support this. But I really would strongly recommend rigorous public outreach education program. We can do that without a lot of expense. And I think once the new wording for the whatever the policy turns out to be, that can be kind of summarized on this brochure with a few little grabbers. So those would be my recommendations.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to add one more thing too. Is Terry, I know you like to be on camera a lot, so maybe put together a little informational video. And that could run on Channel 20 also, since a lot of people do see it. And you could maybe even walk through an illegal conversion and point out some of the safety hazards or something.
Yeah. Steve, this we've got AGP video here. But these are the kinds of things that we should be using Channel 20 for. With all due respect, I'm getting real tired of turning to Channel 20 between council meetings and planning commission meetings now, and seeing nothing but the same old announcements for parks and rec programs and all the other stuff over and over and over and over again. We have an opportunity to use that channel in these kinds of ways, and we're not doing it, and we need to fix that. Okay. Any other discussion on this? Okay, if not, I will entertain a motion. There's a recommendation here for the council to direct staff accordingly on page 1 of the staff report. Anyone?
Mr. Mayor, I'll take a stab at it. It's basically, I would move that the City Council direct staff to proceed with the proposed notice of violation and minor use permit processes to address illegal garage conversions and illegal secondary dwelling units as proposed in the staff report, and direct staff to work on the increased public notification as mentioned
And could you add to your motion and to research the certificate of compliance program also?
Certainly.
I'll second that.
Okay, and to clarify, the public notification, is that public outreach education in the manner we discussed?
Yes.
Okay.
Both in possibly flyers and utilizing Channel 20.
Okay. Good. Second still hold. Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Diggins.
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold.
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello.
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar.
Yes. Okay, that takes us to item 12, City Council Member Items. We have one tonight from Council Member Guthrie.
Sentiment stems from when we received the traffic model, and in looking through it, I know we were going to set up a meeting with the Traffic Commission and Planning Commission regarding, but in looking through it and looking and comparing it with the PSR that we have planned for the going forward for the Briscoe, the changes to Briscoe and also to Grand Avenue, it seemed like there would be an opportunity here to use this model to kind of run a couple scenarios on what might happen based on specifically on the closing of the northbound 101 off-ramp at Briscoe. And it stems from the fact that if, when you look at the model, there's really not a lot of traffic actually using that off-ramp according to their car counts from existing. So what I was going to propose is that we would have Omni Marines run a couple of scenarios based on closing that off-ramp. And by a couple of scenarios, I think that what I see happening in traffic reports, and I'd like to say that the probably another 20 or 30 seconds per traffic transition by closing that off-ramp, and in effect relatively few cars. I just did some quick calculations. It represents 10 to 20% of the peak business or the peak traffic circulation at that point that would be redistributed somewhere else. And that's really, really kind of what we would be looking for is what happens when it gets redistributed. Does it just impact some other intersection, or does it get redistributed to an intersection that maybe can handle it? And if I'm going too far here, just coming up, because I know we're not supposed to really discuss it, but I mean, as an example, you have a significant amount of the traffic is getting off at Briscoe and making a left-hand turn. We don't really know where it goes from there. We just know they make the left-hand turn and go on through the intersection. If all of that traffic came back around and just was at El Camino and Briscoe, we probably wouldn't be gaining much, although there's even less traffic at that particular intersection. So I think that's the kind of modeling we would be looking for them to do here, and both as potential for improving Briscoe, but also just as an educational device for actually trying to use this model to determine what changes to the circulation would happen with different possibilities out there. So that's what I was looking for. The cost of it, I understand, is $300 to $800, depending basically on how many scenarios we ask them to do. It's relatively cheap compared to what the cost of some of these improvements are. So that's what I was looking for us to do.
Well, I guess my initial response to that is, obviously we can't do anything with this unless District 5 Caltrans decides to go along with it, aside from studying it. With regard to studying it, I tend to agree with some of your observations. I don't think that... given the different factors, the time of day, I'm not a big fan of different scenarios being studied. As we've said over and over again, we've had so many of these different traffic studies and modeling that, in my mind, are not the most reliable for planning purposes. I am, however... I would be, I think, supportive of looking into some actual behavioral patterns in terms of trip redistribution. What that would mean is that we put a couple of K-rails up there at the top of the intersection and we temporarily close it off, just as we would if it was being worked on. and then we study perhaps the impact that it has on northbound Grand and northbound Camino Mercado. The whole delicate issue here is the changing, the environment changes. When that hotel goes in, it's going to change. Mm-hmm. And so, it's hard to get your arms around these things with so many different pieces of the puzzle, I guess. But I'm, given the, in my mind at least, the limited success that we've had with the validity of traffic studies, I would just as soon deal with actual behavioral patterns in terms of distribution, and model that.
I guess I'd say you're just, well, that would be the next step to me, actually, would be if you did the study and it said that there was any chance of success or that there was some, how it would have to work to be successful, then that would be, I was going to say, this is the one example we can actually do something that we can undo. And I guess in my mind, we'd want to at least use this tool to study whether, because it may come back and say it's just a silly idea, that there's no chance it's going to work. There's no reason to even inconvenience anybody for 30 days, because it would take more than a couple of days to really know what's going on here. So,
My point, Jim, is that you can study the thing, and this is not science, unfortunately. And it would say this is a silly idea, yet if we were to go up there and put a couple of K-rails up there and shut it off, we might find out that it's a darn good idea, that it works just fine.
I hear you. Believe me, as Ed can attest, I'm very doubtful of the studies. But I guess that what I want to do was create this range. Otherwise, this model is really pretty worthless. We shouldn't have spent $30,000 on it, let alone, $500. I just would like to see us use it to see what potential there is. A classic example would be to do two or three scenarios. I suppose I almost guarantee you one of the scenarios is going to say it's okay. If you pick an extreme enough redistribution, you can make this work. And then close it off and then see how it really does turn out. And it really does give us something of a test for the model. I guess that's the first step. I also couldn't see us going to Caltrans and say, hey, next week we'd like...
There's been a PSR or PANED and we're ready for construction. We darn well better game it for real, to see if this is really going to help before we start tearing up asphalt and planning, sure. Planning ice plant on an exit. So, these are things that, we have to... when we look at this study here, I'm looking at any kind of a revised study the same way I'm looking at a PSR and a PANED.
Well, so. I guess I could support that as well. If you want to, change the direction to staff to approach Caltrans today about closing off that off-ramp to see what happens for some period of time, I'd be supportive of that as well. I just, like I said, I think this is an interim step that sort of gets us toward that. There's been no study done on closing that off-ramp without having the changes, and I think one of the key changes is the change at Branch and Grand. That in fact allows anybody that currently is getting off at this off ramp and going back towards Old Ranch Road or Rodeo, that they actually don't have to make the left turn from Grand onto Branch as it is now. So that part has never been studied. Now that doesn't, I agree with you, it doesn't prove anything about whether the study would be there. But if we created that impact, we could create a whole series of problems going forward from that if we didn't take a look at it. But I could support your alternative as well.
Well, is your intent here, Jim, to have this come back as an item on a future agenda?
Yeah, I guess it was my intent, but I guess we could expand the item to include your proposal as well. No problem with that.
Okay, well then everybody else needs to chime in if you want it to come back.
I'm fine with it coming back, and I think that the options would be whether we do phase one or phase two or phase one and then phase two as options on that when it came back.
How do you feel, Jim?
I don't feel like we need to study it any further. I think that if this model is going to be no different in regards to the PSR that we've already conducted with the projected models, I think we need to move forward with the project. And it's going to be years out, but I think that we've done the studies. And it's, at this point, it is speculation. And I don't think that by plugging the numbers into this model are going to give us any clearer idea of how it's going to function than what we already have. So, secondly, I think it's a little the Halcyon Briscoe PSR is much more complicated than just closing off an exit, and I think that that may prove to have some significant or maybe nothing significant, but the PSR itself is a much more comprehensive approach. And I know in an ideal world it would be nice to be able to model it, but reality is that we have to go with, you know, make our best judgments based on the information that we have been given us, and I think that we have that information in the PSR already.
How do you feel, Jeff?
Just looking at closing the Halcyon Briscoe Road off-ramp in a vacuum and without any other changes, I'm not particularly enamored with looking at that. It's just one part of the puzzle. And to just take that one step and nothing else, I'm not sure would really do us much good. So I'm not real keen on studying it.
Okay, I'm fine with that. Disappointing, because I'd like to know. I'd like to know if it did us some good. I mean, we might look at an improvement to Briscoe today that happens right now and doesn't happen, you know, 5-10 years from now. And all we're doing is closing off the off ramp for 30 days or something.
Well, I think you can take it a step farther. Maybe it'd be to close it and close the on ramp there too.
We couldn't close the on ramp without the addition of the other Old Ranch Road on ramp. I mean, there's 450 cars every morning getting on the freeway at that point.
Okay, I got you. Yeah. And then we'd be pushing them all down to
Grand or something. That would be huge. That's too. The reason that I thought this was interesting, because it's a relatively small piece of the traffic picture, but it's a big piece of the signal picture. And all I was looking at is that today it might actually work, that it would improve Briscoe, you know, not to see or better, but it would improve Briscoe today based on the fact that you had longer signal times. That's what I was looking at. Now, I was hoping the study would tell us. I understand, you know, I certainly understand all that hesitation, but I would sure hate to get 10 years down the road and find out that, gee, we could have made it better today with a relatively minor change. Not fix the whole thing by any means, because there's lots of stuff going on here, as you said, but the one change might improve things today. And we're way past the whether this should be an item, huh?
Well, let me ask.
Their preferred location. The city does not really have any role in the process as far as, since they're a federal agency, they do not have to come to the city for any kind of approval. But they have sent us a letter asking, basically notifying us we have 30 days if you want to file an appeal on the selection. From a staff standpoint, one, this is something we've been working very hard on for years now, with the ultimate goal of at least maintaining a post office in the city, which was something we were very concerned about not being able to achieve. So from that end, we're pleased. Amongst the final locations, while this location isn't ideal, we think it's probably the best out of the three final positions. We know there's some traffic concerns and parking concerns, which we're both going to be coming forward with some ideas to try to address. There were some options early on in the process, namely the Village Center and the location of the school district property directly across the street on Traffic Way from the post office that we thought would be preferable sites. The post office did not select those for a number of reasons. But they were not in the final three in the final evaluation. But anyways, I wanted to throw this on the agenda informally just to see if there was interest or direction to staff to submit any comments to the Postal Service.
Well, I have an issue with it, Steve. I'm not happy with that location at all. I don't think our community is happy with that location based on the feedback that I've gotten. I just don't think the post office has, you know, has done their homework in terms of the, you know, the circulation within that parking lot and the available parking that's there. And I know that the, you know, the postal operations on the weekends, at least on Sunday, are not going to be as much of a factor. But if they're open half day Saturday, you couple that with the traffic from Miner's Hardware, which on the weekends is significant. I think we're going to have an issue there. I think we're going to have a problem inside the parking lot in terms of circulation. I think we're going to have a problem on Station Way, and I know we're going to have a problem on Traffic Way. So I'm concerned about it from a safety standpoint. You know, that being said, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. If there's a, you know, I don't want to write a letter to them, you know, maybe doing a formal appeal, but they need, you know, they at least need to understand that that we're not happy with that position. At least I'm not happy with it. I don't know how the rest of the council feels. I don't want them to leave the village. I don't want them to leave the, you know, close it down. So if there's some sort of happy medium here where we can let them know that we have some serious issues with that location and weigh them against the pros and cons of some of the other locations. I don't think they've really done a good job of evaluating traffic in that location. So I'm very concerned about it. I'm concerned about it from a circulation and safety standpoint. So I guess my response to it would be that we take advantage of this 30-day window and send them some form of a letter that says, look, you know, if the alternative is for it to shut down and not be here, then go ahead, however, and list our concerns.
I'd agree. I think that there will be circulation problems in the parking lot, but then also particularly we're going to have some traffic impacts at Traffic Way and Station Way. I think that's going to be a problem. So I think we should pursue some form of communication with them just to see if they can't refine this a bit and do a little bit more of a traffic study and see what they come up with.
I can't really add to that. I'm not willing to lose the post office in the village. So if it's all or nothing, then I'd say all. And I'm not even sure I'm concerned with the parking lot as much as I'm concerned about what's going to happen at station traffic. I think that left turn is going to be a problem.
I'm in agreement, although I'm probably a little less concerned about it. I didn't like the other alternatives that they had come up with, and so I wouldn't want to see us go there. And I'm not sure they're willing to look at the alternatives that I think would be appropriate. So I think we may be left with that spot. And if that's the case, then I think that I'd rather have it there than not.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. We certainly don't want to lose the post office over it, but I think another approach would be to ask them to, you know, continue their search a little bit. And you've got a car coming out of there, and you're trying to be the one getting in. Somebody has to stop in the middle of the road and make it work out. So I think if we ask them and maybe send it to the property owner as well, that we have concerns about that, and let them. I mean, it's going to cost them parking to enlarge that, and it's difficult because it's changing in grade. So it's not as simple as saying, okay, let's just chop the sidewalk back a bit and widen it. But they do need better internal access, and they need a plan for how they're going to deal with both Miner's deliveries and the postal deliveries, and particularly the possibility that at the same time, and specifically where are the postal boxes going to be located and how is the public going to have access to them.
Okay. I think I've got a pretty good feel of how we might be able to structure a letter. How about if I just draft something, send it out in draft to each of you, and give me your comments if you want to add something or change something to it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Any council communication? I just want to. You know, I was going to do this at special presentations when the fatigue factor hadn't set in, but I just wanted to acknowledge, first and foremost, our community. Today we had our Central Coast Hurricane Relief fundraiser right out here on Branch Street, and the response from our community was just absolutely incredible. We had Meathead Movers out here with a fairly large moving van, which we nearly filled. And city staff, of course, set up. I've got and several volunteers in the community came forward, and we were really moving hot and heavy out here, categorizing stuff and labeling boxes and packing. And Councilmember Arnold lent us his strong back, and so he was a taper, box taper extraordinaire. But I really want to personally thank. Chuck Fellows, Chuck and Linda Fellows, and Kristen Barnick. They were here before we opened, and they were the last ones to leave. And I don't think I've ever seen three people work harder. And but all our volunteers did just a great job. And so I want to thank the community for just a tremendous support of this event. And I know that the people back in along the Gulf Coast are going to be most grateful with the effort that we put forth, and I'm sure they're grateful of what other communities have done. But I would like to think that that we did the best work. So, again, my personal thanks to the community for supporting this event. It was a tremendous success. Do you want to add anything to that yet?
No, I think you covered it very well. It was phenomenal. I think the truck, as you were saying, almost had nothing in it when it showed up, and they had to leave because we ran out of boxes. And I think staff is going to be delivering a couple of pickup truck loads more tomorrow that were unable to get boxed today. So no, it was very impressive, and thank you.
Okay, staff communication.
Just that I think this is our last council meeting before the Harvest Festival in a couple of weeks, so I need to do my annual reminder both to the community on it's the September 23rd and 24th, and reminder to the council. Hopefully you can participate in the parade or some of the activities, and especially we always consider ourselves well above our neighbors and always look for ways to prove it, so we're going to have an opportunity to come cheer the mayor on as he competes in a cow milking contest with our neighboring mayors and county supervisor.
You know, people have been suggesting that, Steve, but I don't recall ever agreeing to it.
Is there any kind of a formal event with the council? Is the fire truck going in or anything? Because right now I'm planning to be in it with the AYSO group, but I have found a replacement driver for the vehicle.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know Mary's making calls to council members trying to see what you want to do for the parade part of it.
Does anyone have a cow I can practice on?
Rachel has a turkey.
You do, Tim? All right. Okay. All right. That takes us to item 16, community comments and suggestions. Anything tonight, Mr. Ross? Okay. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay. We are adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen.